Blue light's coming on.
Do we have a chair?
Okay, now it's going to get wild.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. This is House Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee. Welcome back, everybody.
Thank you.
I hope you had a good break.
Did we ever leave?
I am opening this meeting of the Higher Interim Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development on Monday, September
18,
2017.
Want me to help you with that?
No, I'm fine.
Welcome to September Legislative Days, everybody. Good to have everybody back. I want to extend a special welcome to Representative Julie Fahey.
Yay.
She's been assigned to this committee. Rep Fahey, would you like to make any brief remarks joining our committee?
Sure. It's like 5 minutes.
Nope.
I'm really excited to serve on the committee. My professional background is as a human resources consultant, so I do issues on workforce with companies and nonprofits. So I'm excited to bring that experience to this committee.
Excellent. Welcome. So for today's agenda, I want to thank everybody for taking time to join us today. So today we have a lot of information coming at us, both from the HEC, Chief Education Office, and other partners. We have until 3 o'clock and a lot of information. So I'm going to ask, I know our committee is always has a lot of amazing questions and really curious about our systems. Because of all the information, I'm going to ask our committee to hold questions until each of our partners' presentation. I just want to mention that I used to work for the HEC, and I appreciate all of our agencies and all the work that they have done. And from that perspective, as our agencies do their give their presentations, I ask that you share with us information that will allow us to help you as legislators. Be frank. Be direct. Let us know what it is that you need so that you can do your job and in providing all the data systems and information that we ask of you. I know sometimes as legislators we request a lot, and so we want to make sure that that if you're requesting that you have the capacity to do it. So we ask that. Let's see. I guess we're ready to go. I'm opening an organizational hearing for the purpose of adopting committee rules. These committee rules are pretty standard, modeled after chamber rules and House session committee rules. They are posted and available on OLIS. Vice Chair.
Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Rep. Wisnett moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Okay. All those in favor said aye. All those opposed say nay. All those, sorry, getting used to my role. All those in favor said aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The committee rules are adopted. All right. We're done with that part. I'm closing this organizational hearing for the purpose of adopting committee rules. Okay. Moving on. I'm opening an informational hearing on education data and data systems. Can I invite Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the HEC, and Amy Cox, Director, Office of Research and Data for the HEC? Please state your names for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the HEC. Great to be back. Before we begin, and Amy really kicks things off, I just want to clarify on timing, because we don't want to overstay our time. And you mentioned a 3 o'clock finish date. Is that for the committee hearing today?
So you have altogether you have 45 minutes, but we want to give our committee members time to provide some questions. So approximately, what would you say? My apologies. Our committee actually ends at 5 o'clock, not 3 o'clock, so that's my error. I know everybody got excited.
Can we vote on that?
Laura.
We were going so good.
I move.
That is my error. Coming in as chair. So my apologies.
Representative members, we will... We'll just take all afternoon. We will be relatively brief, knowing that there's a lot of great information to follow our presentation. I, again, just really want to introduce our outstanding Director of Research and Data, Amy Cox, at the HEC, and just say before she gets started what I've said to our staff several times about the HEC and the work that we do. And there's a lot that we do. In fact, I would say most or everything that we do is important. Some portions of our mission are indispensable, and really there isn't another organization in the state that could or should do what we do. And one of those areas is in the collection of primarily student level data that we use to help inform our own analyses and inform the public and you on progress towards state goals, on higher education's sort of challenges and strengths, and other reports that we provide. So I think this is a really critical area. I appreciate the committee's interest. And with that, I'll turn it over to Amy to introduce herself and address sort of how we do the work we do of collecting data and reporting to the public and policymakers.
Good morning, representatives. My name is Amy Cox. For the record, I'm the director of the Office of Research and Data for the HEC. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I think it's really exciting that you want to know the lay of the land about the data and analysis that we strive to do in higher education. So our presentation today is organized around three areas: the collections that we have, what we do with those collections, and where we do not have data, so the gaps that we might have that may or may not be filled. In terms of collections, the HEC has primarily four data collections, the vast majority of which is student-level records, as Ben noted. They fall into both student academic records and student financial records. There's a small set of supplementary data that we receive and a set of workforce data that we receive in the agency. In terms of academic records, those are students' actual academic records that are collected by the institutions, by our 7 public universities, our 17 community colleges, and private higher education institutions. And we receive copies of a lot of that data that we can pull together for statewide analyses. The content of it is largely academic. There is a set of student characteristics, things like age, residence, gender, race, ethnicity. There is an enormous body of enrollment and completion data, including courses and credits taken, majors, if students have are in a program with a major, of course, certificates or degrees completed. And it is from those data, that those student-level academic records, that we produce a lot of information. I will point out the end of that very first sub-bullet that says limited private. Last year, we began the first collection of student records from private institutions. It is still a collection in its infancy, but it is very exciting to have because it has been a missing piece, in all states, not only in Oregon. And Oregon is leading the effort in that. It excludes student institutions that are part of the Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities for statutory reasons, but it does include all private career schools, which is a significant group of students who go on to post-secondary education and training. We also have student financial records, primarily that come from the federal application for the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA, that everyone who has been a college student or has a college student probably has heard of. And and the supplementary Oregon student aid application. Those applications form the bulk of the financial records that we house and process in our Eugene office for the purposes of disbursing student aid, both the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Oregon Promise, which are our premier state grants, as well as the federal Pell Grant, and a large number of private scholarships that we process through our agency that often have a different set of applications, many of those combined. The content of those records, again, a certain number of student characteristics, like age, residence, also a certain number of family characteristics that are part of that income establishment for the purposes of eligibility. And then, of course, the type and size of grants that are received. We do combine those two sets of records sometimes, although we'll get to that a bit more later in the presentation. They reside in separate systems because of separate histories and separate purposes, statutory purposes, and so they don't exist combined, but we do certainly draw on them together sometimes. We also have a small number of supplemental data submissions, namely in response to requirements to the state for particular bills, requirements we can't fulfill with the student records. Those include community college financial information, which is posted on our website, and public institution staff information at a very general level. And then, as I said, there is a host of workforce data as well that looks at both participants and programs engaged in training. The processing of these data, the operations involved in receiving these data, working with institutions, and especially in terms of analyzing those data, relies on an enormous number of staff in our agency, primarily because we produce a lot of information from them. So about 17 HEC FTE positions work on that data processing. Probably that's about 8 total in terms of working with institutions, receiving data, cleaning it, getting it in our systems, and then the remaining probably about 9 FTE positions working on analyzing those data. Those are not the same. Those are not a single FTE doing one of those jobs. Of course, they're dispersed across multiple staff. We are in the midst of planning a data warehouse to facilitate linking these different systems more effectively so that both in-house we can have a little more facility across these different data systems, as well as beginning the foundational work to be able, in a longer range effort, provide a more public access to those data. The data are stored on state servers in DAS at the Enterprise Technology Services that provides a consistently secure environment for the different sources of data and allows the state to have some economies of scale as well. Our authority to receive these data come from statute, first in terms of our agency statute that assigns the HEC responsibility to establish post-secondary goals and track progress toward meeting those goals. Of course, we can't do that without knowing where students are at. And so that our receipt of copies of the student records fulfills that mission. For private institutions, the private career schools especially, the HEC holds a different role, a regulatory role, and our authority to receive those data come from the statute that relates to private career schools. And in terms of data protection, we also operate very carefully under the Federal Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, which was established many years ago, and protects student records in terms of confidentiality and restricts our use of those data to basically research and reporting requirements and results. And those are the uses that we that we restrict our own selves under. From these data, we produce a wide range of information, a fair amount of federal and state reports that I'll get to, as well as some supplementary reporting to institutions and private organizations related to higher education. We also, especially in our office, are expanding our research and analysis and policy analysis using these data. I think that's one of the most promising areas of work that we are engaged in, and we'll talk about that more in a minute, as well as providing information to the public. The agency produces over 30 federal reports each year, plus over 150 financial reports. These are in response to federal funds that come into the agency, especially the Carl T. Perkins grant, which supports vocational and technical training, and the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which involves multiple offices across our agency. And those two sources of federal dollars also carry with them, of course, a requirement to establish the success of the students in those programs. And that's where a lot of those reports really fall into. We also have other department, federal department reports that we comply with across our agency. At the state level, HEC completes about 36 state reporting tasks each year, many of these in response to bills that the legislature has passed, most of those on an annual basis, sometimes biennial or quarterly. And in addition, another set of reporting tasks at the state level that are not necessarily in statute, but that are part of other state programs ongoing, or requirements such as our KPMs that we provide to you this month, actually, and our submission to the state longitudinal data system, things like that. Usually in collaboration with some of these other reports, we also provide regular reporting to our institutions on a number of programs in order to facilitate their tracking of their students and their progress. These include reports that have to do with students in the Perkins participants in the Perkins program, WIOA participants, as well as adult basic skills, and our state public aid and federal public student aid programs. And then finally, we work with a number of third party, I would say, not public sector, but private sector organizations, not private sector, but independent organizations, to provide data and reporting in order to engage in the national conversation about higher education and support efforts to situate Oregon on the map of how we might grow and where we're doing well in comparison with especially our near neighbors, but really any of the states. I said earlier I thought some of the most promising work that we were doing had to do with policy analysis and research coming out of our office, and this slide looks at that. Two of the deeper dives that we're engaged in right now have to do with the recent bills that were passed this spring or this summer around transfer, community college to public university transfer, Bill 2998. We're quite engaged in looking at courses and majors and credits associated with students who do and don't transfer between our community colleges and public universities, as well as our adult attainment goals associated with Bill 2311. We're also in the process of establishing a number of assessments of state progress in higher education. These include a dashboard to work with on a regular basis with our commission that establishes a set of very sort of scaled down life course metrics for students in higher education, a set of both state and institution level profiles that some of you may remember the Oregon University fact book or the community college profiles. These will serve some of those purposes and some additional purposes as well to give those institutions a consistent glimpse of how what their students look like come and how they're contributing to our state higher education goals. I think in the county level profiles, I want to speak to a minute, return to House Bill 2311, which I think really provides this extraordinary opportunity to engage our local communities in higher education goals in ways that they may not be thinking about on a regular day-to-day basis. The establishment of those other rules engages those local communities in education, and partly in support of that and partly for other purposes, we're also putting together some county-level profiles to work with legislators, local school boards, local higher education institutions, local media to further the conversation around this is what's happening in your county, this is where the students from your county are going, this is the educational profile and how it situates in the socioeconomic profile of your county, and here are HEC financial aid services that your students might be able to get engaged with. So we're kind of excited about all of those pieces. We also, Chair Alonso de Ilm, you mentioned capacity. We also engage with other outside organizations to expand our capacity to look at some more detailed, complicated analyses that then we have the time to be able to do in-house. And those include things like community college career pathways, the Oregon Promise, which has generated a lot of interest, accelerated learning outcomes, as well as the recent transfer bill. One other thing that's not on here that I'll also mention is that we're in our office planning a set of more detailed reports than is possible in our key performance metric report to look at things like at a statewide level, enrollment and completion, and this fall, and next year, equity and affordability. And then finally, we use these data for a set of public information access points. One of which is our website, which was updated last year and has a substantial research and data section that includes basic summary tables and graphs of the numbers of students and enrolled in our public institutions and completions over time, as well as a searchable database of a finite set of common community college student characteristics that people have questions about, as well as I mentioned earlier, the community college financial information reports. We also have a monthly external newsletter that has a featured research and data section, which sometimes generates additional, if you look at the third bullet, additional ongoing media requests. So we do field a number of media requests and other public information requests through the agency on the order of, we field many, but these data are supporting probably a little over one a week of those questions. Although we have such a rich set of data, I can't actually get all of the work done that I want to do in terms of hours in the day to be able to analyze those data. That doesn't mean we have everything. So I will point out in this closing slide the areas where we don't have information, both to give you all a clearer lay of the land of what we do and don't have, as well as to point out some of the questions that we're not able to answer because we don't have these data. The first section is in this green arrow, the linkages that would allow us to track students across different sectors. And we have a strong ability to be able to track students within the community college system, a community college student who goes from one community college to another, or within the public university system. We have a lesser but still, you know, reasonable ability to track students between community colleges and public universities. What we Where we are far more limited is the ability to efficiently connect and analyze data between K-12 and higher education, or between higher education and employment. Even, for example, if you think of something as specific as a Social Security number or a driver's license number, that's certainly not a piece of information we have for every person in the state, let alone every community college student or every public university student. And so being able to connect different data systems across agencies is something that individual staff work on regularly, but that we don't have a unified system in doing. And we're very excited and expecting the results of the SLDS. We're very supportive of their efforts so that we can be able to answer some of those questions, like which students are falling out of an education pipeline, when are they falling out, who is not getting employed afterward, who is falling out in the middle of university and we're never hearing from them again, and who is actually falling out because they got a great job opportunity. These are questions that we can't answer, and so we're very excited about the SLDS. In terms of student information, we have, as I said, a host of information. There's also information we don't have. We don't have visibility into students' transcripts when they enter schools. So what that means is we know, for example, the number of credits a university or a community college assigns that student when they're a new student there. You came in with 30 credits. You came in with 12. We don't know if there are credits that that student took that were not accepted. So if there's a credit loss issue, it's something we can't estimate. Institutional grant aid. Our public universities especially provide a fair amount of tuition remission for a lot of students that we do not, we don't have those data, and it prevents us from being able to really acknowledge the efforts of those institutions in providing that information, as well as to be able to assess affordability in a better way. Related to affordability, we don't have student loan information beyond federal loans. That is not a source of data we could get. It's not that it's something someone could ask for, but private sector loans are just certainly not available. We are expanding the kinds of accelerated learning courses that we are able to track, but there's still a lot of sort of miscellaneous kinds of accelerated learning that high school students might take that we don't have access to. This fourth bullet, identification of high school graduates and degree-seeking students at community colleges, is really key for answering community college completion rates. Our community colleges have a wide-ranging missions that include wide access for students and both credit and non-credit kinds of education, returning students right out of high school, a wide-ranging mission, which does not always enable us to analyze, well, who actually is a degree-seeking student and how many of them completed. More comprehensive racial ethnic options. We have a pretty specific set of racial ethnic categories that is very useful for tracking equity outcomes. Those categories, by definition, are categories. Race ethnicity is a socially defined changing concept that and those categories do limit our ability to do sort of more disaggregated analyses, how African Americans compare to African immigrants, how certain subgroups of Asian Americans fare, sometimes which can be quite different answers for different subgroups. And finally, as I said, the private school data development is still in its new stages. So we are looking forward to that becoming more comprehensive and getting those schools more used to the process of collecting and submitting their data. Also, just for informational purposes, we do not have faculty and staff information at the HEC. That is not that is a change from, for example, the Oregon University system that predated us. We have student-level records. We have a small amount of summary information about staff positions that we have in response to two bills that were passed by the legislature. Beyond that, we're quite limited in being able to answer any other questions about faculty or staff. And similarly, institution budget and expenditure data, we have only very summary information about the ways or the categories of expenses that our public institutions operate under. And with that, I will close this portion and invite any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. We do have some of our committee members who have questions. Rep. Solomon, would you like
Thank
to start?
You. And you may have touched on a little bit of this. First of all, I'm sorry, what is SLDS?
I'm so sorry. The State Longitudinal Data System.
Okay. And I wrote on the top, because when you were talking about some longitude, blank, blank, blank.
Yes, the State Longitudinal Data System, which I defer to the Chief Ed Office to excite you about.
Well, I know that it makes Rep. Johnson really excitable to talk about that.
The jury's still out. We haven't heard their presentation yet.
So I was curious, because I feel like I'm discouraged at the, as I'm sure you are as well, at the where you gap in the information, you know, getting information, because I feel like one of the first things before I saw this and before I saw a couple slides before is I wrote the student academic records, is this information shared with school districts? A former school board member, we used to constantly try to fill in the blanks as to what happened to our students after they left K-12. Because we want to make sure that what we're offering is rigorous and relevant, and are they getting what they need? Are they entering into remedial classes that we need to look and figure out how we can address that? So it sounds like that's a missing, it's part of the missing link
there.
Yeah,
you know, it would, in an ideal setting, we would have either the exact same students who started early learning and went, you know, 100% of them graduated from our public high schools, and we would know exactly where they went afterward. And that, of course, isn't the case. Students come in and out. But in addition to that, in K-12, you know, K-12 does not, our Oregon Department of Education, which manages an enormous quantity of data, does not collect Social Security numbers. So for us to work with them, which we do regularly, and I will tell you that work is expanding, we have to sort of match, and I mean, of course, computers do this. We don't do this one-on-one. But if someone changes the spelling of their name, or they change their they decide to, you know, go by their middle name, and if they, you know, that's the level at which we're trying to match these kids and young adults, and you know, young adults don't always, you know, supply all the information that you ask of them, and so if money is not attached, they, you know, we may have a lot of missing information, and although we can match the vast majority, it's the group that we can't match that we always are concerned about, because those are the ones who tend to be struggling the most, right? I will tell you, though, that we, in addition to the State Longitudinal Data System, which will be doing that matching, we are working on some specific initiatives. So the Oregon Department of Education uses calculates the college-going rate for public high school graduates every year, and we're working with them to expand a breakdown of that so that we can use that as a key pipeline measure for us, as well as on a developmental education, remedial education report that we're actually working on right now in my office, and that ODE will be working with us to disseminate. Of course, it won't be every single graduate, but of those who go off to community college, which is where the vast majority of developmental education occurs, we've broken it down by high school district, you know, what the rates of remedial education are for incoming students, so that they'll be able to draw on that information.
Okay, follow up. Each student does have a student ID number, though, so that is specific to. And I think I don't think it's just per district. I don't know if that student ID number is something that is that number is only good for that kid in the whole state of Oregon. I'm not sure, but they do have a student ID number that they can't even get lunch at the middle school level if they don't have that memorized. So I'm just wondering if we can't have something along the lines of utilizing information through a student ID number.
That is part of what we use.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
That is part of what we use.
Okay. And then my second part of the question was on the transfer. Do you have the ability to connect classes when you were looking at your transferable classes and things? Do you have the ability to show if there's a pattern, if there's a class that is consistently across the board being able to look at and say these classes are not matching up? So I mean, that's a lot of unnecessary potentially school student debt. So being able to address and be able to see a pattern of
yes and no. So to some extent, yes. And of course, the affordability issues around transfer are really driving impetus in our office to be looking at these questions. What we can do is we can identify in our and have been identifying the classes that students seem to be taking that we don't expect them to take if they're transferring in. So, for example, if you transfer in as an econ major from a community college and you're taking Econ 101, that's a bit of a surprise. Like, would you not have already checked that off? You know. What we can't do is identify the students who actually took Econ 101 at a community college and the receiving university did not accept it except as an elective. And that work is happening on a department level with faculty from the universities and the community colleges. So that that's where that question is getting answered more than in our student level analysis, because we don't have that incoming transcript data.
Thank you. Representative Hurd.
Oh, that was Chancellor.
He was being kind when I was asking him.
We're trying to get sponsorships out of her, so I raised my hand.
All right. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Cox, thanks for all that information. My God, we did this to you, huh? slide 7. Are any of those that we ever talked about? I'm a legislator for some time. I remember seeing some of these, but not all of them. If we ever considered saying we need to have a sunset on reporting requirements like we do for taxes now, we go back and look at every 3 years or 4 years and see if you still need that data. Have we talked about that, or is it a problem enough that it needs to be addressed?
If I may, Representative Wisnett, Chair Alonzo Leon, there are reports, and they're not included here, but there are reports that the HEC or predecessor organizations used to supply to the state that had sunsets, and as a result, we no longer supply. So it certainly is not unprecedented. There may be, and I haven't talked or checked with Amy about this, there may be sunsets, upcoming sunsets, in one or more of these, although I would guess that the majority of them do not have sunsets. And of course, the legislative history for each of these bills is different and unique and may have included that discussion and may not have. I certainly think it would be worthwhile for the legislature to consider when it adopts a new reporting requirement, at least considering the inclusion of a sunset on it. And we would be happy to work with this committee or others on a review of existing reporting requirements and potential repeals where the value has diminished.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Cannon. We may want to talk about that as a committee or look at that. Are all these reports on your website that the legislators could look them up and get copies of the reports?
The vast majority of them are. I would have to I didn't do a review prior to what is this presentation to
thank
make
you.
Sure that.
Thank you, Director Cox. Slide 8, what is the SLOV report, SOLV, S-O-L-V-E. Why are we worried about
Oregon littering and vandalism?
Why are you doing that one?
That comes out of our Office of Workforce Investments and is part of a program and a required part of that program is my understanding. But I can check with them and follow up with you about, in particular, the SOLV report.
Finally, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I can't see it now, all these different reports. You mentioned that you do not have faculty information. I thought I saw a report on here about faculty, something about faculty.
We have for House Bill 2152 and Senate Bill 113, we create reports that look at the number of supervisory positions and the number of management positions compared to the number of classified positions.
That used to be 2020 House bill, but I think it was changed. Slide 13, you were talking about that you don't have this data on the faculty. House Bill 2946, very great bill, that How are you going to implement that if you don't have some data? How the university is going to respond to that? It's for the transparency website.
Representative Wisnett, Sherilyn Zaleone, I think we'll have to check back, report back to you on specifically how we're implementing that bill or how that responsibility may fall upon the institutions themselves.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. let's see, Amy, on slide, I'll go back to the slides too. Slide 13, under missing student, or miss some of the gaps. So you addressed, I think, a few of these topics, but is there a strategic plan, I guess, bullet by bullet, to address these gaps and to be able to open up and glean this information? Because as we're going to get into this report, we're going to get from the chief education officer, I think, they're going to talk about some of the missing gaps in the SLDS, and I think a lot of it's directed here. I guess I'm just thinking that system-wide there should be a plan to say, we don't have this information now by X date. We're going to figure out how to make it happen, because some of this is really important stuff.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Some of it is really important stuff. I completely agree. I will tell you that our plan regarding the green bullet is really a plan that's being implemented by the Chief Education Office. Okay. So, but moving to the brown bullet, transcript data is an issue that will undoubtedly be part of the discussions around House Bill 2998. I don't want to preempt those faculty discussions. Sure. Because I am not a faculty member, nor registrar. That said, I'm sure that transcript data will be a part of those discussions in order to clarify the number of credits that that universities receive and assign as elective or don't receive from incoming community college students. Regarding institutional aid, that is not, we've only begun to really calculate affordability this past year for this past year's KPMs, and so we're now in the process of identifying, well, what pieces are we really missing? And so in the coming year or two, I hope to be able to have those conversations with the universities. I do expect that the universities would be supportive of at least summary measures of that kind of institutional aid, because it is information that that acknowledges their hard work in providing a more affordable higher education. Accelerated learning courses, we are in the process. We have a process of incorporating more of those measures within our community college data system, where the majority of accelerated learning occurs. So high school students taking college classes are primarily taking them in the community colleges, and so they're sort of the first layer. We do, as I said, measure a number of them, and we do have plans for further measuring in community colleges. we've taken those plans sort of as far as we can in terms of the state of the field. So there's a fair amount of sort of unspecified credit that occurs through sort of one-offs, students taking a class, that kind of stuff is harder.
Which you don't have to go through item by item. I just want to know you were going to address it. But you bring up another topic, though, that I think that I just had the conversation with the chief education officer is related to Measure 98. And as that gets, we implement and so forth, throughout, we're emphasizing more dual credits. I think it would be the intent that those credits earned would not just simply be empty elective credit, well, not empty elective credit, but just simply electives, but to see how is the system using those within a content area that can be usable towards a major, and that's to be determined. And I know there's a lot of work that'll need to be happened between K-12 and post-secondary in the time to come, but that's another one I guess I would flag for you guys too, because that'll be a real important conversation going forward.
I would say that that the state of data in the field for that is following closely where the policy is. Mm-hmm. So it's not an area where I feel like we're grossly behind, but rather where the policy is still evolving and emerging, especially with 98.
And just one more follow-up, if I might, Madam Chair.
Sure.
On slide 11, the bottom bullet there in the red sector, you talk about community college to university transfer, and one of your partners there is Echo Northwest. How are they helping you in that?
That is a brand new partnership.
Nice. I'm wondering.
Yeah. And do you want to speak to
that? Briefly, Representative Alonzo Leon, Representative Johnson, and as Amy said, this is a request that we got just within the last couple of weeks for a project that Echo Northwest is working with the Ford Family Foundation on to help analyze data with a particular interest in the same question that this committee and our commission has asked about the success of transfer students, particularly in the transfer of credits from two-year to four-year institutions. So it is yet another set of eyes on this problem, and they're using or will be working with some of our data to help analyze it.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. I have a few questions. Understanding that we have one of the highest dropout rates in the country, I've not seen in your information what we're doing in respect to capturing data for our GED students. We obviously work with our GED students. We know a lot of them are using all the resources within our community colleges to earn their GED, but it's not part of your reporting system. I'd like for us to add GED as part of your reporting system to make sure that we're tracking them. Once they earn their GED, where are they headed? Are they headed to community college, university? Are they headed to apprenticeship programs, career technical programs? And what are we doing to support their post-secondary opportunities? What are we doing with that? I know that we have a great partnership with GED Testing Service at the national level. They provide that data. I know that, we can continue to have that partnership and report back to the legislative body so we can see where those students are going.
Chair Alonzo Leon, thank you for that question. This is exactly could be an additional bullet in the green arrow at the top. Because we don't have a unified system, it limits our ability to track those GED recipients. So one of the things that we are beginning to do more is identify them where we can within the community colleges and universities so that they can be a regular way that we stratify enrollment and completion, and there is an essential next step, which is to link those students so that we can track them over time. Absolutely.
Great. My next comment actually is it's in respect to what's going on right now in our country with DACA students. We know that we don't track our DACA students because we don't track whether they're documented or not. But understanding that we have some very tight deadlines for students to renew their application or go through that process, the deadline is October 5. All applications need to be in by then. What are our community colleges and universities doing? How's HEC helping that process to make sure that our students are informed in respect to key deadlines and information related to DACA?
Chair Alonzo Leon, members of the committee, it's a key issue. On September 6th, the HEC joined 43 public and private institutions, all of our public institutions and a whole bunch of our private institutions in issuing a statement that calls on Congress to deal with the issue and support DACA students in recognition of the contributions that they have and will make to Oregon's future. So that statement's available on our website. In terms of getting out the word, we've just last week forwarded on to our campus partners information that the Department of Homeland Security has provided, really intended for students or people working with DACA students, to alert them to the deadlines, for example, the October 5th deadline for re-enrollment if they're expiring before the six-month window is up. And we will continue to work with our institutions to help them get the word out. As you know, Chair Alonzo León, we typically, with the majority of our students, are not working directly. We're working sort of through the institutions, and they have the relationships individually with those students. But we will continue to support them in getting the word out to potentially affected Oregon students.
Thank you. Thank you for all of the work that you do on behalf of our committee. Any last questions, committee members?
I have one.
Okay. Make it quick.
Okay. No problem. Thank you, Chair. I had a question about I estimated it was $2.5 million. I could be wrong. Maybe it's $250,000 to generate all those reports. It looks like 25 employees. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing $100,000. Is that $2.5 million? Can you confirm how much are you spending to generate the reports?
Representative Bynum, Chair Alonzo León, we'd certainly be happy to get back to you with sort of precise information. I think your sort of back of napkin probably gets in the ballpark at $2.5 million. But that is funded through a combination of federal dollars. So as you've seen, quite a bit of the reporting that we do is federally required and tends to be supported by federal dollars that we receive. Some of it is other fund supported through the fees that we assess, particularly with the private institutions. But there is a significant state general fund investment in Amy's staff and other staff within the organization that are helping support this data work. So we'd be happy to follow up with the sort of breakdown by fund type for our employees who are involved in the data and reporting work.
Thank you. Thank you for that great question, Representative Bynum. I know that since I've left the HEC, they've hired a lot more data people to basically address all the questions and all the reports that need to be written. So I appreciate all the work that you guys have done. Thank you so much. All right, thank you. We're going to transition over to the second panel. Can we have Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer, and John Starr, Project Director for Chief Ed Office. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Alonzo León, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lindsay Capps. I head the Chief Education Office, and I'm very pleased to be here today to provide a report on the status of our statewide longitudinal data system, or the SLDS. I'm pleased to be joined by John Starr, who will present as our project director on status and what we see as key outcomes for that system, as well as Director Cannon, who is a collaborator in this effort as the head of the HEC, along with our Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor at ODE, among others. John will talk a little bit about the purpose and use of the longitudinal data system. I just want to highlight a couple of key themes that I think have also come up in the prior presentation. The first is that we have really a challenge currently in making sure that data and data over time is readily available and visible to multiple users in our educational system. And that data, as Amy Cox talked about, in terms of higher ed, is not connected across the system. So in large measure, this is an attempt to write that system and make it more integrated. That's important, I think, for really two critical reasons. The first is, we talk a lot in this state, and the governor's committed to this, and I know many of you are committed to this, is really build building this seamless system of education. And longitudinal data is really a connective tissue for that system. It's critically important to our commitment around equity by being able to see in deeper ways and analyze in deeper ways how students are transitioning across the system, what outcomes look like across populations of students, and probably most importantly, how do we know about and address key barriers across those key student transitions that occur most often in our pre-K to K-12 system and from K-12 to higher ed, as well as, I think, as we all know, our transition from higher ed into the workforce. So this is a great tool in terms of broadening and deepening our commitment to equity and operationalizing that in real ways across the system. The second piece, and I think related to our work around equity, is to strengthen partnerships. I think you already heard Amy talk about some of the things that are emerging around not just improving outcomes, but thinking about participation and access. Accelerated learning came up today. There's a piece of information that we don't readily have that by having that data available to us, we can begin to partner across sectors and frankly across communities to improve access to high quality programs that we know have an impact on high school completion and college completion for that matter. The last thing I'll say before turning it over to John is it's important to recognize, just as in the HEC presentation we heard today, and with the chair's admonition to be real about where we see gaps, there are gaps in data. So the system that comes online shortly will need to evolve and emerge and grow. And I think the opportunity, as it is used by various folks across the state as a public-facing system will help us, I think, to assess those needs and deliver on those needs as we're collecting and expanding our data into the system. So with that, I'm happy to turn it over to John to present a little bit more about the SLDS.
Thank you. Madam Chair, member of the committee, for the record, my name is John Starr. I am the director of the statewide longitudinal database. Just going through a few elements, the agenda today. Kind of touch on what the purpose of the SLDS is, how Oregon's data system will meet the needs of the users across the educational continuum, some of the short-term deliverables that we are looking at, and opportunities for future system development, of which there are many. This is an element that is often misunderstood. SLDS is a term that has been used interchangeably since 2005 for a variety of different data systems. Longitudinal, by the nature of it, deals with data over time and the linkage of that data. So it's intended to look at student history over a set period of time. And with our particular system, we're looking at being able to set the parameters over what that duration of time looks like. It's being provided to aid in making informed decisions through data for educators, for administrators, administrators, for policymakers. The data in and of itself is not a decision maker. It's to provide the information to make informed decisions so that we are looking for the best interests for the students that we serve. Improve student learning. We have the ability to look at student cohorts over time. Again, we have the ability within the system to set what that cohort span of time is. If you're looking for a specific school year, that can be set. If you're looking for a cohort from kindergarten on up through higher education, we can set that period of time as well. It's intended to enhance research. We don't know all the questions But we want to be able to take and offer the opportunity to answer questions that researchers come up with. And researchers, by nature, can ask almost anything. We want to identify access to the outcomes as we move through, and we want to be able to take and look at specific student populations and regions. In turn, we are looking for this to inform policymakers again in the event, or I shouldn't say the event, in the order to provide allocations as necessary where it will serve the greatest population in need. Short-term project deliverables. Today, we have consumed information from ODE from kindergarten through grade 12. We have consumed information from the higher education community, four-year and two-year. And we have consumed data from workforce from the early 2000s to present. So that's the package that we have today. What that provides us is student demographics, degree status, and course history. That's at a very, very high level. We can go much, much deeper than that, but the intent is to have that level of granularity. We want to have real-time automated access to this information so that researchers, policymakers, educators can go into the particular system, set the parameters of what they're looking for, adjust the parameters as they are experiencing the system to get the information needed to make informed decisions. The information provided allows for statistical analysis. The tool in and of itself can give data that would prompt a direction, but it's like any data system, intelligence must be applied to it. It does not answer all the questions. It allows for analysis of student cohorts over a vast array of characteristics, demographics, ethnicity, gender. Whatever data is provided, we can look across that entire spectrum to be able to take and look and connect data over time. The information is protected. One of the priorities for the project is to ensure privately owned information is guarded. The information that we receive from our partner agencies is encrypted from the time it is sent into our environment. Once it's in our environment, our applications run continuous encryption as when the data is in-house as well as it's when it is within motion. On top of that, the Informatica application that we use conducts continuous masking of that data, so we're triple encrypted down through the end result, which is the data warehouse. So doing our best to be data stewards and ensure the privacy of our students is maintained. Current data. School districts. From school year 2006-07 to present, higher education, community college, and public universities, same time frame, and from workforce 2000 to present. To give you a scale, workforce is approximately 2.4 million entries that we currently stand in hold of or contain. This is just a screenshot of some of the data. It's intended really to convey the reporting or the visualizations that can be used with the application. The best way I can describe it is it's a very sophisticated Excel. You have the choice to go in and look at three-dimensional columns or three-dimensional squares. You can do graphs. You can do, it will do literally everything that you want it to do based upon the audience that you want to communicate to. Within, oh, as well as tabulations. One of the key elements in the choices of the applications that the project team did was to engage an application that can consume data irrespective of its format. We can consume Excel files. We can accept DB2 files. We're not really limited by what format the information comes into us. We can read it, consolidate it, and organize it. So that's not a limitation for us using the applications that we have in place. This is, again, a snapshot. It does show very clearly the application is connected to geocode. So we can link data to physical location within the state. This particular example allows choice for school year between school year 2014 and 15 and school year 2015 and 16. So you have two choices. Those are the parameters that are set by the user. For in this particular application, this was to aid chronic absenteeism for our state. We got to choose either 0, 25, 50, or 75% chronic absenteeism. And as you change those parameters, the circles on the map move and change because, again, it's linked to the geocoding. It will tell you where those conditions reside. Going further, you can either request all students or grade level or race and ethnicity, depending on your choice. Below the map gives you the tabular data that corresponds to each of the circles that's indicated in or on the map based on the parameters that the user sets. Like all great programs, there are some clarifiers that are needed for the user to understand the limitations of the data that they're seeing. And that's what's contained in the lower right-hand side of the slide that you're looking at. Visualization examples. These are some of the examples of visualizations that we had developed for us. Core chart example, quite honestly, I can explain it, but it doesn't make any sense to me. But people like this because it's like a Sankey diagram, except for it goes into a greater level of detail.
I don't get it.
The Sankey example really kind of models what the Oregon Business Council has done. And it follows a specific cohort through the historical journey that that particular cohort goes through. So if you choose a specific cohort from sophomore, from, say, 2006 to present, it will take and run you through that three-dimensional view and tell you where those students ended up. Now, these are not specific to the individual because the data has been de-identified and it's been grouped together. So it's looking at a cohort history and not an individual history. It gives a very good picture of what happens over time. In this particular example, this was for a particular school year, a particular cohort. What they looked like in eighth grade, what they looked like in ninth grade, what they looked like in high school, what they looked like after high school, and where they're at today. It's a very telling story, and it really gives a clear picture on a historical view of a particular cohort. The heat map is just another representation or visualization of the data. Rather than having a tabular form, where you're looking at the columns and the rows, this gives you an instant response to the data and the parameters that the user uses for the data. In this particular case, this heat map shows the number of Hispanic students, female, that are engaged in STEM curricula over all years. Very powerful. It really, really shows areas for opportunity moving forward. When we offer the system the first of this year, there will be actually five interactive reports that will be available to the public. They will be able to set the parameters for these particular selections. They'll be able to adjust the parameters to get the results based on the parameters that are set within those offerings. So this is our this is our first offering. We expect significantly more as the data system progresses. Further system development. We are already in communication and have been supporting the early learning division of ODE. Their data collections are lagging about a year and a half to where they have a system that is transferable. They've got quite a bit of work to do, but they're very interested in partnering with us and sharing their information so that we can give an even broader longitudinal view of kiddos. Oregon Health Authority has expressed interest in teaming with their information. Again, it starts to fill in the holes of data over time that currently are missing from view. Department of Corrections. The hope is to be able to see trends, to see vantage points in time that if we start to see a specific trend or trait that we may be able to intervene, may be able to offer alternatives to help those folks. We're looking at doing predictive models and modeling moving forward. This would be forecasting type of information based on historical data. Expanding, like I spoke to earlier, real-time automated data access and depth, and then continuous improvement and stewardship of the data quality. Having seen the data, having linked it across the different sectors, there's areas that we can help and give visibility to our partners where we may see something that needs correction and or clarification for us. I want to be respectful of your time.
Thank you so much. Committee members, anybody have questions, comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for this information. I appreciate that. You had touched on something about the Department of Corrections, and recently I did have the opportunity to see the expansion with down at McLaren, where they had been working on their expansion model and what they're doing to serve the young men that are there. And I'm wondering if part of that snapshot that you're talking about being able to track, does it also track within the corrections? They have the educational programs within the corrections there to be able to say, this is where we're seeing a strong, I don't know what the term is, so that they don't reoffend, you know, strong program of success for rehabilitation. Are you able to, like, are you looking at trends before, or are you looking at trends also while they're in a system where there is education? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Madam Chairman. Great question.
Okay.
Actually, what we love to do is to get that entire picture.
Yeah.
Because it fills in a gap that we currently have right now. I think looking back in time, being able to influence trends that we see in that particular population, that gives us opportunity. Having visibility to that period of time within their environment, I think will provide the same level of trend opportunity mm-hmm. that we may be able to analyze opportunities on both ends of the spectrums. I know that until we actually start to exercise the information, since we haven't received it yet, it will show us opportunities that we haven't even thought of at this point.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, comments? Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, John, appreciate the report again. Just to confirm, this will be accessible system-wide, let's say, school district superintendents, college presidents, school board members, that sort of thing. But there'll also be the opportunity to take deeper dives if there's something or some yes. additional collation of things that they don't see. They can make a request, and you guys will do the research or pull that together and present
that
reports.
Is correct.
Is that right?
Yes, sir. It is. I think one of the things that if you look at it at various different levels, the public facing is going to be limited to a set, what I'm going to say, portfolio of information. As we start to ratchet down, researchers will be able to and have access to the system to be able to develop those questions and set those parameters themselves. And we plan to do that for our partners.
Could you touch on the financials and so forth as well? We've got states invested resources up to this point. Going forth, I'm sure there'll be maintenance of effort and just to keep your operation going. What do you foresee that to be?
The project in and of itself was granted in the 2016 session, $5.05 million to start the project effort. We've requested additional funds of 1.5. Don't hold me to this. I can get you the actual numbers. 1.5 to complete the project, plus the sustainability or the O&M of the project team going forward on out. The operation and maintenance costs, and I'm projecting here, for 5 full-time equivalents moving forward, plus the maintenance of the software licenses, is right at 2.5, 2.7 per biennium.
Okay. And one additional one, Madam Chair, if you could. Just again, getting on this to back to the staffing question and personnel question, we heard from the HEC that they've got approximately something like 25-ish people working on data collection and numbers crunching and stuff. Chief Education Office has 4 or 5. I'm guessing ODE has a staff doing similar work. Are we sure that we're not being redundant in some of this work and that that we're processing and gleaning data as efficiently as we can? Mm-hmm. That's my question, I guess.
Sure. I'll step in here. Representative Johnson, Chair Lenzalone, I think it's a really good and appropriate question. And I can say for our standpoint at the HEC, as the SLDS comes online, we will be evaluating and reevaluating our needs. Frankly, our needs have been greater in supporting the build of the SLDS than they would have been without an SLDS. But it is certainly possible that with high-functioning SLDS, our needs would diminish, and that's something that we will evaluate when we see the system.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
And Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say I love data. I really like the data that you presented. I like this in conjunction with the census data. I think it's a statistical atlas, which, you know, late at night you can have just a party with data. I highly recommend that if you're a data person. But what I thought was really compelling was as we look at equity work, as we look at the corrections data, finding out who's affected where. And it wasn't lost on me that the high school, the chart you showed about chronic absenteeism, there was a line straight down I-5, and then there was a line along the coast. That's not by chance, right? So there's an opportunity there for us to intervene and create policies that really take a look at targeting geographically where we want to put our efforts. And I was recently at the coast, and it brought it home to me. Our rural communities really, really need our attention. We have the population and the money in Portland and Eugene, but our rural communities really need our help. So thank you for all the data and the work that you're doing.
Thank you. So I have a couple comments and a couple questions. So on slide 11, you mentioned that ODE data is lagging. And so then that makes me think about how our systems are talking or not talking to each other, mm-hmm. right? You know, some systems are older than dirt. Some systems are newer. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about those challenges and what we need to do to fix them. I think this is the part where it's important for all of us to better understand our systems within our agencies and how they're either hindering us from achieving some of these data collection goals and what we need to help fix that.
Madam Chair, great question. The nuts and the bolts of the data collection in and of itself, we don't collect everything all at once. The individual school districts collect at a period. Those data collections come into the Department of Education at various different times throughout the year. So you don't get one check and you're off and running. They trickle in over the entire year. So to get the entire picture, you have to wait until that entire collection is in place. So there is a dead band period of time between the various different data collection periods. So that creates in and of itself a gap in the data. Likewise, with the higher education groups, they have different periods when they transmit information. It's not on December 24th. You just, you know, the gates open and everything comes. So you're receiving information over an entire year. And in order to take and align that information, you take that snapshot in time, over time, to be able to see the results of that. Am I making sense? Sort of, kind of. So it's a very dynamic reporting structure. There's information gaps in and of itself. As an example, we have a student that graduates from an Oregon high school. But they attend college in Idaho or Montana or Arizona. We lose them, and we lose them for that period of time. The only way that we would see that student come back is if they re-enter the workforce. Mm-hmm. Now we have that linkage between that individual and when they were in public school here. There's organizations that we haven't really poked at that can help provide those gaps, but that's a future effort in the development of the system. So that's an opportunity. Students that graduate, and this kind of goes to GED that you were talking about, that information is available. If we have a student that graduates with their GED and then goes into the military, we lose them. They gain education, and they gain a lot of education during that period of time while they're in the military that we will not have visibility to unless we can gain access to that data. Again, that's another future opportunity.
Thank you. So I know we've done a lot of research on equity and reaching out to our members of our communities of color. And so for me, it's really important to also track. We've done the research. We've done the data analysis. We've put work groups into plan. They're doing some good work around making sure that those segments are being reached out to. Is the SLDS able to then help us understand if what we're doing is really helping them achieve that ultimate goal?
I believe so. Let me see if I can get something. I'm sorry if I'm breaking protocol here, but this particular chronic absenteeism, if I had an operational system, we would be able to take and go into this and see the parameters set. If we go into the year 2014 and 2015, set chronic absenteeism at 75 or greater, and then move into grade level, and you track across the grades, from grade one, you don't see chronic absenteeism. Grade two, all the way up to grade eight, and then at grade eight, you have this huge spike of chronic absenteeism. And it also identifies where in the state you have that problem. Huge opportunity for community engagement, getting people to understand what's going on, because you've been great all the way up to this point, what happened? And that's where you get community engagement to help solve that problem. Okay. And you can track that over time.
Thank you. Yes.
Just to amplify on that, because I think the real power, that's important, but what a longitudinal data system then allows us to go on to do is understand how that pattern of chronic absenteeism affects that student, that person, years down the road, right? Maybe a little while before we're doing that with 2015-16 data, but for example, what's the likelihood that a cohort with high rates of chronic absenteeism completes high school or earns a college degree, right? How do those things relate? And so identifying, I get really excited about this longitudinal work, and I think John, in some respects, undersells the potential power of it. But we're trying to figure out what leads to higher education success, right? What are the factors at a young age that impact higher education success? And today, we cannot answer that in a systemic way. But with this system, I hope it will be possible for us to know, how does a factor like exiting ESL at fourth grade or at 10th grade or not exiting ESL impact a student's higher education access and success? Or how does student mobility within K-12, we know we've got a lot of students transferring a lot. What does that mean for their future likelihood of success in higher education? Right? Those are really important, or even something as basic as their third grade reading score or their free and reduced lunch status. How does that relate to their access to higher education or their lack thereof, and success in higher education or lack thereof? And that, I think, understanding those questions will allow us to drive resources at the points where they will make the greatest difference, even for higher education, right? So to me, that's where so much of this sort of longitudinal piece, what's really unique about this, comes into place. I'm sorry, I sort of jumped into your presentation, but I can't help myself on this topic.
And if I may, yes. Madam Chair, I think one of the conversations we have with folks across the state
And it speaks to both John's comment about the opportunity to engage with impacted communities and to Ben's comment about seeing the connectivity of how we are supporting, intervening, providing good practices around student learning. We hear often from regional collaborations around the opportunity where cross-sector partners are coming together in education, in healthcare, in workforce. The opportunity to look at longitudinal data as a opportunity for them to assess their regionalized strategies, most especially around equitable outcomes for students. And so there's a huge opportunity that currently doesn't exist. To make that data visible, accessible in real time, to be able to customize that analysis is going to be really important. And so to your good point, it will deepen our work around equity, I think, in really substantial ways in the classroom for students and families. That's the hope.
Thank you. Well, we're running out of time, but one last question, Rep. Solomon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you touched on this, but you know, when you talk about how many reports that so many of these that you have to file, you also have to think about the school district. So I think it's really important that we have a system that, you know, you have school districts that are like working with Naviance and all these different things. So then you're also having them now having to enter this information in. No, I heard that wrong. Okay. I was trying to figure out why it was trickling.
The information that we receive is already collected by our partners.
Okay.
We consume information from the HEC, from Workforce, and from ODE. This is no additional burden on boots on the ground.
Okay.
This is the same level of activity and work that they're currently doing.
But how is it getting to you? It's not an additional. It's already a program that's already in.
That
I'm
is
seeing
correct.
Nods.
Okay. We, to put it in real simplistic terms.
Yeah, thank you.
We have their data.
Uh-huh.
And we have an encrypted pipe.
Okay.
That goes from their data.
Got it.
To our environment.
Okay.
That's the new piece.
I was just wondering why it was trickle and falling in every once in a while instead of.
It's a technical term.
Instant keystroke. Okay.
Rep. Johnson.
Just a final comment. I just wanted to appreciate Ben channeling his former Governor Kitzhaber in giving an impassioned description of the original purpose behind the OEIB and having good data so we can make informed strategic decisions about where we need those investments in that P20 contingent. It's taken 8 years to get there, but it sounds like we're getting close. Yep. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm closing this informational hearing. Quick side appropriate. Okay, moving on. I'm opening an informational hearing on workforce data and data sharing. We'll have introductory statements from Bob Uhlenkott and Bridget Daisy. Thank you. Please state your names for the record.
I'm Bob Uhlenkott, the Workforce Economic Research Division Director for the Oregon Employment Department.
Bridget Daisy, Executive Director of Clackamas Workforce Partnership and Chair of Oregon Workforce Partnership.
All right, may begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Alonzo Leon and fellow committee members. I'm Bob Uhlenkott, the Director for the Workforce and Economic Research Division for the Oregon Employment Department, as just mentioned. For a decade, I held this exact same position in the state of Idaho. There I was, one of Oregon's actual data sharing and data leveraging partners. For the last 10 years, I've witnessed Oregon's commitment to be on the leading edge for enhancing administrative records, as well as the effort to pursue numerous opportunities to share and leverage data with workforce partners. That is one of the many components of the job that attracted me to this position in Oregon. In fact, Oregon's efforts to collaborate with both inter- and intrastate partners has garnered national recognition from federal agencies and the U.S. Department of Labor. In this year alone, the department is collaborating with a multitude of federal, state, and local partners, as well as participating in a national interstate data sharing agreement in a pilot program. These collaborations have resulted in nearly 100 contracts and data sharing agreements that are designed to leverage the valuable administrative and research data we all collect. Many of those key workforce partners are here today, my employment department colleagues, local workforce development boards, Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and the Department of Human Services. We have shared in advance a handout with you that briefly summarizes the who, what, and why about a few of Oregon's workforce data systems. The subject matter experts behind me will be able to answer your questions about how they fit in the broader workforce system and how they complement our partners' programs. I will briefly touch on the performance reporting information system that involved these same partners. Back in 2012, the leadership in Oregon's workforce system and other architects of the PRISM, we call it, the Performance Reporting Information System, were trailblazers. They saw the need to better establish measure and publicly disseminate workforce outcomes of the workforce programs partnering in the PRISM system. Trailblazers, why? Because 2 years later, in 2014, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which I think you're all familiar with, was enacted with a heavy focus on workforce system collaboration and data sharing that result in better performance reporting, performance measurement, evaluation, and ultimately better programs altogether. And in recent weeks, another example of collaboration is key executives from core state workforce agencies are collaborating with research subject matters like myself, matter experts like myself, and other workforce partners to collectively discuss methods to better leverage and utilize the existing PRISM system. Also, it should be noted the Employment Department has begun a large modernization initiative to evaluate, improve, and replace core business and computer systems that support the Unemployment Insurance Program and the Workforce Operations, Employment Services, and Labor Exchange. While the initiative is in its early stages, the department will engage with workforce partners to understand customer needs as we move forward. Changing gears a little bit, I would be remiss if I didn't share with you just how timely and at the forefront the topic of workforce data and data sharing is today, even at the national level. Only just a few days ago, Senators Patty Murray and Paul Ryan, along with the Federal Commission on Evidence-Based Policy Making, held a joint press conference and released their 138-page report retitled The Promise of Evidence-Based Policymaking. This final report focused on several recommendations around the benefits and challenges of employing evidence-based policymaking. Four of them are very relevant to our topic today. I'll talk briefly about four of them. One, the value of collecting enhanced administrative records, the value of data sharing, and the value of leveraging those data, and most importantly, the extreme value of data security. In short, the group rejected the idea of one large, single, federally managed data system. They rather endorsed a more federated approach that leverages the Fed-State partnership that better protects the confidentiality and privacy of customers' data. If you will, it's like not having all your eggs in one basket. If you're interested in more details, you will find that workforce data sharing and leveraging are referenced and discussed at great length throughout the entire report. Ironically, it should be of note that on that exact same day, September 7th, Equifax announced their massive data breach. To me, it illustrates the enormous importance of this data sharing topic we're here today to talk about and the value of developing federated data systems using thoroughly vetted protocol data sharing agreements that might involve any sharing of personally identifiable information. In the questions you sent to us in advance, you talked a little bit about barriers. I'm going to change that word to more like challenges because I think barriers is a pretty strong word. I think there are challenges, however. The collaboration of partners in the development of data sharing and leveraging systems certainly aren't void to these challenges. There are many federal laws that are designed to protect customer data, and Oregon's data sharing agreements are designed to comply with those federal laws and safeguard customer data with the necessary security and infrastructure and protocols that protects confidentiality and privacy. For example, just to mention a few, we're all familiar with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. HIPAA provides data privacy and security provisions to safeguard medical information. Also, the kind of overlap into the workforce, the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, which we're all familiar with, protects the privacy of student education records. Also, laws we need to comply with, maybe less known, are the confidential information. This is a quite a handful. Confidential Information Protection and Statistical Efficiency Act of 2002. In our Bureau of Labor Statistics circles, we call it SIPSE. This was established to standardize confidentiality of data and, in bold terms here, develop the appropriate protocols for sharing data for statistical purposes. And even closer to home for the Employment Department, the many unemployment insurance federal conformity laws are designed to protect customer rights and data. The unemployment insurance program's administrative data is the primary source for determining earnings and employment outcomes, a key variable our partners value and use. In the worst case scenario, noncompliance with federal unemployment insurance conformity laws would result in significant federal unemployment insurance penalties, showing up in the form of higher federal taxes levied on Oregon businesses to the tune of potentially $500 million. So as you can imagine, our workforce partners take federal compliance and the protection of confidentiality and privacy very seriously. In closing, the Employment Department, Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and the Department of Human Services remain committed to improving workforce services through increased collaboration and data sharing with our partners. We are also working with a broad range of partners, including nonprofit organizations, private businesses, and service delivery organizations. And through the Oregon Workforce Partnership, state workforce agencies and the 9 local workforce boards meet monthly to collaborate on how to best meet Oregon's workforce needs, including continued progress on data sharing, an important local level forum for collaborating and exchanging these ideas that move all the way from urban Oregon throughout rural Oregon. Working with our vast array of partners, including local boards, we collectively are able to serve our customers all across Oregon. With that, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Bob. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Alonzo Leon and committee members, for leading this important conversation. We appreciate the opportunity to work with you to ensure state and local workforce efforts are meeting the needs of all Oregonians and our business partners. Again, my name is Bridget Daisy, Executive Director of Clackamas Workforce Partnership, and I am here today as Chair of Oregon Workforce Partnership, the association comprised of the 9 local workforce development boards and state partners joining us today. We would also like to thank the governor and state agencies for their efforts to modernize state data systems and associated practices. This is a much needed undertaking that we hope will position the state's technology infrastructure to most effectively support the current and future business needs of the state and the multitude of Oregonians it serves. We are hoping this conversation opens the door to the bigger picture, future state. One of your questions was, what does the ideal future state look like? And I'll come to that in a minute. I would like to start with a comparison of the healthcare system and Oregon's workforce system. Our structures in many ways are different, yet there are some distinct similarities if you'll bear with me for a moment. We have all visited or called a clinic or doctor's office and shared details about our health, only to be referred to another doctor or clinic to fill out similar forms and provide information regarding our health needs. Have you been transferred from one department to another, had to repeat your story or situation, and been frustrated by the need to repeat yourself or fill out duplicative paperwork, often having to track up follow-up on your own? In many ways, the workforce system is like the healthcare system in that clients accessing services through WorkSource Oregon or a partner agency branch office face similar challenges in how records are kept and shared, how personal information is collected, and how a client's progress is managed through multiple access points. Now let's walk through a potential scenario for an Oregonian needing assistance to obtain or retain employment in today's economy. Let's imagine that a client walks through our WorkSource Oregon door for support in job search or training. The intake process to enter information into Wellness and iMatch Skills takes anywhere from 30 to 60 minutes. Information about their income, demographics, education, and work history are gathered. They do so and begin a journey to assess which tools and resources from our system partners could benefit them on the road to self-sufficiency. This individual, depending on their age or barriers to employment, could be referred to or qualify for programs with DHS self-sufficiency, vocational rehabilitation, older worker programs, Job Corps, the community college, Title I funded programs, and so on. Depending on which programs and services make sense for this individual, the client may have to complete additional enrollment processes, with each asking many of the same questions as the original WorkSource Oregon registration. At the same time, staff assisting the client are now not able to know, other than client self-attestation, which programs they are already enrolled in and receiving benefit from. For example, a client may be receiving food stamps, and a WorkSource staff may or may not know this, depending on whether it is disclosed or if staff has access to this information through data sharing agreement among partner organizations and agencies. If staff across all system partners have the opportunity in real time
to know pertinent information about a client. It takes the guesswork out of the equation and allows staff to provide meaningful support in an efficient manner while reducing duplication of effort and resource. The data environment used to support the WorkSource Oregon system is unique in that WorkSource Oregon is a shared state and local system. By design, WorkSource promotes the alignment and integration of programs and services to better serve clients and is made up of several partners ranging from federal and state programs to local agencies, nonprofits, and education institutions. Understanding the local workforce ecosystem and sharing client service level data between all partner organizations is essential to seamless customer service and to achieving the vision and promise of WorkSource Oregon. With record low unemployment rates and a huge demand for workers or talent, we have a small window of time to create a stronger value proposition for private sector partners to tap into the talent we serve. More of our community is living in poverty, has limited access to reliable transportation, may have a criminal history, and faces discrimination because of reasons like the color of their skin, their gender, age, or disability. This means more assistance and resource will be necessary to help them achieve their goals to self-sufficiency. So what does an ideal future state look like? Ideal means all partners, through the use of 21st century technology solutions, being able to access and enter data in a way that allows multiple partners to serve the same client in a meaningful way. Solutions such as simple data sharing agreements are options that our system is using to some degree. The opposite end of the spectrum is one data system used by all workforce partners. Local workforce board supports modernization efforts of state legacy systems. We understand that the state government modernization is bigger than the workforce system partners represented here today, just as the workforce system is comprised of many other partners also not represented here today. So modernization efforts do not necessarily address the challenges we are attempting to bring to light for WorkSource Oregon, its clients, partners, and staff. The Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, Section 107, and the State Workforce Plan requires local workforce boards to accomplish 13 primary functions. One of those is to coordinate the service delivery or the delivery of core WIOA programs through the one-stop service delivery system. Another is to develop strategies for using technology to maximize the accessibility and effectiveness of the local workforce development system. To adequately perform these functions, there needs to be a clear process for engaging local workforce development boards in state-level conversations about changes that may impact WorkSource, including the use and functionality of related systems. What do we ask for from the legislature? One, to review any regulatory or legal constraints that impact data sharing between the state and local workforce boards. To ensure compliance by state agencies with mandates of federal law by acknowledging the role of local workforce boards to lead and to be involved in the development of real-time technology solutions of which data sharing is a component. An opportunity to come back to the committee prior to the start of session to update you on progress and to identify any ongoing challenges related to WorkSource Oregon system coordination, and to designate a neutral body to provide an oversight of all system partners in order to provide a mechanism for dispute resolution. We don't expect resolution today. This should begin our path forward. This will take time, collaboration, consensus building, and be informed by what's working and what's not. At the core of it, this is about serving people better. We must, as public servants, reduce our clients, community members, and businesses' frustration working with the public sector. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Bridget. Great introductory comments. I think we have a lot of work to do, a lot of challenges, and I think this is a perfect way for us to have those discussions and to move forward together. Thank you. Appreciate it. I just want to mention to the committee that we have about an hour and 10 minutes. We're going to have the discussion a little bit more inclusive in that I'll be asking several questions for our next panel to once they come up, and then you'll be able to ask some questions. And then so there'll be about five different sets of group questions for them to answer, and then for you guys to follow up with some questions. And I'll just, after they do their presentations, I'll be asking if there's any committee questions. Thank you both. Our next panel will be Jen Farrar, Division Director of Workforce Operations, Oregon Employment Department. Bridget Daisy, she's going to stay here. Karen Humblebaum, Director of the Office of Workforce Investments with the HEC. Dan Hahn, Deputy Director, Self-Sufficiency Program, Department of Human Services, and Pete Karpa, Deputy Director, Vocational Rehabilitation, Department of Human Services. So, committee members, you should have the questions right in front of you. We should have a hard copy so you can follow along. Okay. And just a friendly reminder, please state your name for the record. Let's go ahead and start from one side. Doesn't matter which side you want to start, to state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pete Karpa, Deputy Director of the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, Department of Human Services.
Again, Bridget Daisy, Clackamas Workforce Partnership.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Hahn, and I am the Self-Sufficiency Deputy Director. Self-Sufficiency is a program in the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, members of the community, my name is Jen Farr. I'm the Workforce Operations Division Director for the Oregon Employment Department.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Hummelbaugh. I am the Director of the Office of Workforce Investments at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Excellent. Thank you. So we have the big picture question for you all. So the questions are the following. What is the purpose of the data systems that you use, and how do you support your work? Or how do they support your work and mission? Who are your customers? Who are your data systems designed to serve? And if we can have, do you guys have a set who's speaking first? It doesn't matter. Okay. Let's let's start with Pete Karpa.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the big picture for data sharing and data agreements for the Vocational Rehabilitation Program. We're a pretty unique program. We're data rich. We get a lot of information through our automated case management system. It's called ORCA, Oregon Rehabilitation Case Administration. The purpose of this system is predominantly for case management and to collect data that reports to the federal funding sources and other state partners in order to report the performance metrics that are required through the WIOA and to give our partners the aggregate data that we can utilize for program administration. Our primary customers then would be the RSA, which is the Rehab Services Administration of the Department of Education. I say the PRISM program, which is OED, and then also most importantly for our VR counselors to utilize in order to perform the work that they do. So the primary design of the system when it was conceived is for RSA and VR, and it's a program that's operated by AWARE, or sometimes called Alliance. It's a contractor, and it has the same system with various individual state modifications for 38 of the VR programs in the country.
Thank you. Let's have Bridget Daisy go next. We'll just go in line like this.
Okay. The purpose of the data systems that we use is to adhere to federally mandated responsibilities under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, particularly as it relates to the innovation and use of technology. Under 107, again, we have the responsibility to develop strategies for using technology to maximize accessibility and effectiveness. Our data systems track expenditures, leverage funding, track information regarding participant eligibility, activities, progress, and outcomes, and support customer-centered case management and service delivery. Our customers are vast. We have funders, and our customers are funders and investors, both public, private, federal, state, and local, WorkSource Oregon partners that use access our data systems in various ways, such as OED, DHS, HHS, CCWD, you know, the alphabet soup, cities, counties, senior employment, veteran services, unemployment insurance programs, trade act, contracted service providers, and so on, Oregon Workforce Investment Board, employers that need qualified workforce, Oregonians in need of seeking assistance, attaining, retaining, and advancing employment, community partners and stakeholders, and local elected officials. And who are our data systems designed to serve? Staff needing to verify
verify and track customer eligibility, service provision, customer expenses and performance outcomes, customers accessing services through WorkSource Oregon, investors and funders needing to accurately report on customer outcomes in order to manage their return on investment, and local boards and state agencies are responsible for program oversight and compliance.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Alonso Leon, earlier you mentioned that there have been programs around since DIRT, and the programs we work in are those programs. Our programs, our data systems built on a 1967 platform, so that's 1967 is in the year. I think Jim is the only one who was actually born. Well, maybe Pete, too. Actually, up here, who was born at that point.
Friends.
We have 49 or so programs in that system that we work with. And the primary function of our systems is to administer our programs, to determine eligibility for benefits, issue benefits, and to provide case management services. You know, when doing eligibility for our programs, our staff can go into anywhere between 3 and 14 programs to determine eligibility for our clients. The benefits we administer to over 1.2 million Oregonians a year include the SNAP program, the TANF program, and the employment-related daycare program. So it's really those programs that we administer in through the self-sufficiency program. We also now administer the STEP program. That's the self-sufficiency training and employment program that's grown from 2016. We had 4 providers to now in 2018. We have 23 providers. We've gone and during that period of time from serving 6,088 participants to now estimated in 2018 to serve about 38,500 participants. So it's that program where we see a lot of crossover with the workforce world, and it's that program that has really, I think, driven a lot of the changes we've seen in how we use data between the self-sufficiency program and the workforce world, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk about that shortly. Our systems are primarily for Oregonians, in my mind. That's what we do. That's who we serve. We obviously answer to our federal partners in Food and Nutrition Services, the Department of Education with our employment-related daycare program, and through ACF, adults, children, and families at the federal level as well. But I think primarily our number one reason for providing services, those 1.2 million Oregonians.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so our system we have is a labor exchange system, and it also works as where job seekers come in and enroll into the system. So we have actually two different systems. We have the workforce management system that we work with, the HEC. It's in partnership with the HEC. That's the point of entry when a job seeker comes in. A lot of that is eligibility requirements that get through that. The system that we have for Oregon Employment Department is IMAT Skills. That system is our labor exchange. So we help businesses. We've served over thousands of businesses last year just to help them with recruitments. We served over 200 and some thousand job seekers last year that came through in IMAT Skills to get registered in IMAT Skills. That system we then take and the individual gets registered. We then match that individual to jobs based off of what we have from employers that list job listings with us. We work with various different partners, the local workforce boards around sector strategies. We use that system to help place individuals in the sectors. We also just launched out with Department of Human Services where we know anybody that comes through on the STEP program for the food stamps, if they're eligible. That way we can help that individual right then and there, knowing that they're eligible for that system or eligible for that program, and we're able to do that. We're also most recently going to be working with the adult bodies without dependents as well. Starting in October, we will also know if an individual qualifies to that through the Department of Human Services as well. So there's various different ways. We are the first point of contact. Majority of my staff in the WorkSource centers, they do see the face of the individual when they walk through. They're the ones that greet those individuals. So firsthand, the system that we use indicates whether they've been enrolled into the system, and then the staff member then can better serve that individual and refer them on to other organizations that might be able to help them within the one-stop system.
Sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to speak just to, you just heard a lot about the HEC side with the education side of the data in the, earlier in the committee. So I'm just talking about how this supports the workforce side of the house at the HEC and the mission we have in connecting Oregonians and Oregon businesses, making sure folks have the skills that they need. Our customers range from our funders at the Department of Labor, you as legislators, the governor, to the state and local workforce boards that you've heard references, all of our partner agencies and grantees that we have. Our primary responsibility is for the accountability and performance mechanisms, strategic direction. We use that data in the systems for technical assistance or policy decisions that need to be made based on that. And I think as we get into the conversation a little bit more in terms of talking about who the systems are designed to serve, we have front-end systems like Jim was talking about with the customer registration. We also have PRISM, the PRISM. You have the acronym there, but it's Performance Reporting Information System. And those are places where we deposit our data and we look at it and analyze it and make decisions from it. So I think as we walk through this conversation, there are different looks to just talking about data systems.
Thank you all. Thank you, Jean. Any questions from the committee? Okay, so we're going to move on to the next set of questions. This is related to data systems. WOMIS, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correct. I match skills, I track my workforce and PRISM. So please describe each of the four systems and the data collected. OED, WOMIS, I match skills and PRISMs, LWDBS, I track my work source. Which data system is currently shared among these systems and with whom? Which data is not currently shared among these systems and with whom? Describe any cases where a lack of sharing is appropriate from your perspective. Describe any cases where sharing doesn't currently exist but probably or possibly should. Let's go ahead and we'll start with Bridget Daisy this time, and then we'll just go across.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So iTrack is the system that tracks Title I adult and dislocated worker programs as well as youth programs. WOMIS actually, Jim is going to be able to get into detail. WOMIS determines eligibility into Title I. Those systems do talk to each other, so it goes from WOMIS to iTrack and populates into iTrack. But through iTrack, programs funded through local workforce boards are managed to provide program information, data that is closely tied to the Workforce Oregon Management Information System, iMatchSkills, and PRISM. The statewide system is used by all 9 workforce boards in addition to several community colleges and other organizations and nonprofits. It allows contractors to verify and track customer eligibility, service engagement, and performance outcomes in our Title I programs, state and federal grants. It's integrated and web-based, and we also connect to programs like My Work Source to connect people to services such as workshops and other programs available, as well as Train Oregon, which is a new program that we don't have listed on this, but is another system that connects job seekers to curriculum and other certifications and credential training. That the customer-facing part of iTrack is really My Work Source, to be able to virtually connect to Work Source, self-direct online training and whatnot. Which data is currently shared among these partners and with whom? iTrack data is shared with HEC weekly, which is used to populate PRISM and issue federal reporting elements for Oregon Title I programs, participant registration information gathered in WOMIS. iTrack shares last service date with WOMIS for common exit and re-registration, and within the WorkSource Oregon data is shared by way of confidentiality agreements. Which data is not currently shared among these partners and with whom? Participant information from Title I, Adult Basic Skills, Department of Human Services, Self-Sufficiency, and Vocational Rehab is not accessible to all staff. Information from
other required Work Source Oregon partners and programs such as DHS Senior Services, Second Chance Act or Department of Corrections programs, Trade Act, Housing Authority, DHS National Farm Worker Jobs Program, Job Corps, and Youth Build. These are also not shared within ITRAC. Authorization to view WOMIS, ITRAC, and IMATCH skills data may be available to partner staff with appropriate training and confidentiality agreements, and information related to business services and work training learning is not shared among partners. Any cases where lack of sharing is appropriate from our perspective, information not related to eligibility or participation in Work Source Oregon programs, partners, does not need to be shared within the context of the workforce system. So as long as it's pertinent to the work that we do, we would like to see it, and if it is not, then we don't need to see it. And describe any cases where sharing currently doesn't exist but probably should to effectively serve customers and maximize resources. Again, based on my initial comments, there's several places where we could be sharing information to better serve our clients. Currently, HEC cannot share wage record interchange system or federal employment data exchange system employment data with ITRAC. This data is used for performance reporting with the Department of Labor and PRISM. The lack of sharing creates inconsistencies in what staff are tracking for employment placement in ITRAC and what is reported for PRISM and the Department of Labor. Department of Education and education placements and credentials should be shared with WorkSource Oregon partners by HEC. Those, and then enrollment and services in other core programs such as self-sufficiency, Title II adult basic skills, and VR, among other partners that make up the workforce system.
Thank you. To help us better understand, because those systems are all interconnected, and I'm a visual learner, so my brain is trying to connect all of those. Jim, I think it might be helpful if you then explain a little bit about WOMIS and IMATCH, yes, skills and PRISM. That way we can connect the systems that you just mentioned with the, and she mentioned some of the other systems, if you can just explain what they are and how they function together. I think it'll help us.
Yeah, so WOMIS and IMATCH skills are interlinked together. So when a job seeker comes into the one-stop center, they automatically will have to be directed to log in and register into WOMIS. And that data will determine whether they're eligible for Wagner-Pizer or the Adult Digitally Educated Worker Program. So it's kind of an eligibility system that gets them in there. But a lot of that information that is populated into WOMIS then also goes into Oregon Employment Department's labor market labor market system, which is the IMATCH skills. So the IMATCH skills and WOMIS are, like I said, are intertwined with one another. So there's data that's populated that, so a job seeker doesn't have to come in, register into WOMIS, then turn around and then re-register every data information that's already asked into WOMIS back into IMATCH skills. So that's where that's populated into both of those systems and interact. A lot of the information that's in there, I can just run down. I mean, there's job seeker and employer information that's in there in both of those systems. The job seeker education history. There's also an employer job matching system that's listed in there as well. Unemployment insurance claims record, so that's populated into IMATCH skills through the unemployment insurance database. So an individual wouldn't have to then go into our mainframe system to see if somebody's eligible on unemployment. A lot of that data is already on IMATCH skills, so that's populated in there. So if you're working with a job seeker and they say, well, you know, I think I'm getting unemployment, I'm not really sure, there's actually an indicator in that shows that they're getting it, actually will give a snapshot of their claim summary so they don't have to end up going into another system to look that up. There's employer tax records that's also in that. So as we're working with businesses, it'll show in IMATCH skills what employer tax records they're in there. So if we're working with the business, putting the business into IMATCH skills because they have a job listing, we have to make sure there's an employer-employee relationship. So by doing that, that information is already in that database. Historical wage data is also in the system as well. So we do keep wage data for a period of time, and so that information is in there so they don't have to go into multiple systems to look that up. We also pull information to ITRAC for both the Wagner-Pizer and the Adult Dislocated Worker. So on a nightly basis, information is pulled to ITRAC, which is what Bridget was talking about earlier. So that information is pulled to ITRAC. It is not pushed back to the state data system. reasons beyond that, but it's just a one-way. One-way, so it just pulls to it and doesn't come back. We also, like I said earlier, we're working with Department of Human Services. We implemented on the STEP program, which is individuals who are on food stamps, where that data is populated into IMAT skills. So when a job seeker walks in through the door, that information is there, so they don't have to then look it up, call DHS, find out the person's eligible. The staff member will know right away. The other thing that we're working on right now is the adult, the ABOD. I'll just, because I can't remember what it is right now, but the ABOD, we're working on that right now, where a person will walk in the system, and that'll be effective October 1st, to where the staff from OED who will be doing that program will know that person is eligible for that program as well. Another thing that we did back in 2012, we automated the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. That was huge. We get data from Department of Human Services on a nightly basis to determine whether a person is qualified for the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. And that, before we did the automation and getting the data from Department of Human Services, our backlog on that program was insane. I mean, we had more applications that we could even process, and we couldn't get it done. We were almost 2 years behind on processing those. But with the partnership that we did with Department of Human Services, getting that data, we are now like 2 to 3 months behind, which in theory, that's not really behind, because the amount of time the applications come in, you have to process them, it takes a little bit of time. So we're pretty much caught up on that. And like I said, we started that in 2012, but we actually implemented it in 2014. That was a huge, like I said before, it was a huge undertaking that we did, and it worked out really well, and we're able to process those quicker and faster. Let's see, what am I missing out? We also do the Trade Act Assistance Program through the two systems. So anyway, that's affected with foreign trade. That program is also incorporated as well. And then we do state and federal reportings through that as well. So we have a mandate to do state and federal reportings through our system that we are required to the Department of Labor to report. That system also tracks that as well.
Excellent. Karen, why don't you go next?
Let me just add a... They wrote it down for Jim, so he'll know next time what AVOD stands for. So let me make a couple clarifiers. We do jointly own the WOMA system, and we dump our data into the PRISM system, and we work with the other systems. The three state systems that we're talking about that are sort of combined and shared are the WOMA system for customer registration, the iMatch skills, and the connection it has with wage data and customers and businesses, and then the PRISM system, which all of us up here are putting information into that we're looking at, because it's a way in which we can look at and analyze the data, and that's jointly owned by everybody. So folks have already talked about those. The iTrack system is a locally driven by the local workforce board system, and as Jim talked about, they pull the data down into their system, and so that they're able to utilize it, but it is not a state system. So I just want to make that clarifier, and heck, we've already talked about through the other systems that folks have talked about.
So, Karen, I mean, I'm going to break a rule a little bit here just to help us, I think, understand. So PRISM is essentially an analytics system that you all gather and import information into, and then be able to break down the necessary information for your respected programs.
Correct. Okay. Chair Alonzo Leon and members of the committee, I am not a technical person, and to me it's the big place we dump all of the data from all of the systems so that we can mix it all up and look at all of the data for the whole system.
Thank you. Thank you for indulging me, committee members.
Remember that chart that we got with all the...
Oh, I'm thinking.
Okay, Dan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to talk about all 49 of our programs if I could, for a minute, and what they do. No, I'm just kidding. When I look at these questions, I think the one thing that I think, there's a couple of things, but one thing that I find really important and worth talking about is that relationship now between iMatch Skills and the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services, through federal and state laws, is not allowed to share its information on recipients unless it's part of the management of our program. And what we did
back in, I think, the winter of last year, has looked at iTracks and looked at iMatch Skills as two potential places where we could manage our STEP program, our SNAP 5050 program. As a program where through the federal government, DHS is able to match 50% of the money spent on our clients in this program. Historically, like I said, back in 2016, we had four programs doing this, and we did it by, like Jim kind of mentioned, someone would come into their office or to us, it wouldn't be your office, you weren't a provider then, but into one of our provider's offices and say, I'm ineligible for this program, and we would call at night then and check with one of our employees who would get into our database and verify that they were indeed a participant in the SNAP program. And then we would monthly track services on a Excel spreadsheet and mail it to, they would be mailed to the Department of Human Services so that we could ensure that billing was accurate and that an individual did not receive services or the same service from more than one provider. So a truly labor-intensive process. What we were looking for in the winter was the ability to match our growth, to be able to, as with this program's grown and touches more people and involves more programs, 23 programs this upcoming year, most of them outside the current workforce system, that we were able to manage that data, that individuals could get services from multiple service providers, but couldn't get the same service from multiple service providers, because that's against the FNS rules, the Food and Nutrition Services rules. So what we determined was, knowing that each of those 23 providers also have their own case management system, because they may serve vets, they may serve individuals coming out of the correction system, they may serve disadvantaged youth. They all had their own case management system. So what we wanted was a simple system that someone could log into quickly, identify themselves as a provider, figure out that, yes, indeed, that individual was eligible for the SNAP program, write a short plan, and take services, and figure, and then anyone who was a SNAP provider of ours could get access to that information. So they would all know in relative real time. I won't say real time. Data out of our 49 systems is rarely in real time. But we could know pretty quickly whether that person was signed up with another provider, getting services from that from a provider, and what specifically those services were. We went with iMatch Skills for a couple of reasons. One, it was behind the state firewall, and as we've talked about other, as we talk about Equifax and some of those things, that means something to the state agencies to know that we're sharing our data with a state agency that is that has to abide by the same rules we have to abide by. It also made it easier for us to be able to audit if we went with one provider rather than trying to get information individually to all 23 separate computer systems that our providers use, our current vendors of the SNAP program used. The benefits of this, I think, are just awesome. A small nonprofit like Dress for Success in Portland is going to be able to participate in a 50-50 program, get matched, keep track of their data in a way that allows them to run their business without buying another tracking system. That was one of the downsides of iTracks for us at the time when we looked at it, was Jim and his staff were able to build out the components that were necessary for all 23 of our providers with their current staffing and some additional federal funds provided by us. The iTracks system was going to charge our vendors, our participants, our vendors who were using the system, a usage fee, and that felt really not so great to the Department of Human Services to ask these small nonprofits who were providing this service to pay a fee in order to put the data in a system that we needed them to put in order to run the program. So that was a couple of the reasons why we went with iMatch Skills. It's been a huge benefit. Same with the WOTC program. I don't think it can be said enough about what that means to Oregon employers, the Work Opportunity Tax Credit, and what that, for those of you who aren't familiar with the WOTC program, does is gives employers a tax credit for hiring individuals in certain populations. Two of those populations are populations that I serve, the TANF population and the SNAP population. We're able to match that data. When you have a two-year backlog, it's really hard to convince employers that the system's still even out there and working. When they say, yeah, I hired one of your clients in the past, and I never got my tax credit. I think it was a year ago that I did that. It's really, really hard to convince them to hire another client. So the automation of this system has just had tremendous impact on employment for our clients, because they're able to, the pre-screening tool that employers use, check it, and it means something to employers. So that's been a real, I think, boon for hiring of individuals who receive TANF and receive SNAP.
Thank you. Pete.
As I mentioned, Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I mentioned earlier, we have kind of a unique case management, case administration system, which for us basically does the record keeping, service delivery, payment, and identifies data that we are supposed to obtain for our federal reporting. And there's 384 data elements that we need to report to our funding source every quarter. And so a big part of the ORCA system then is to collect this data. But in the background, while a VRC or vocational rehabilitation counselor is doing counseling work with their client directly. So a lot of the information that we have then when it comes to sharing goes from the ORCA system to PRISM. There are a few exclusive arrangements and agreements where we have data sharing agreements or data usage agreements to share specific programmatic information in order to identify mutual clients that could be called out for to be looked at for other services. One of them is like the WOTC system. The WOTC system does a comparison so that people know that this person could be a VR client, would therefore be eligible for the WOTC system tax credit. One of the things that comes out of that, though, is they could also be eligible for the tax credit through being a veteran or being a food stamp recipient or being someone from the DOC, which is a much higher reimbursement rate. So at some point along the way, someone needs to decide which one of those to go with. That being said, however, the predominant information that's shared is who our clients are in aggregate. The big problem for the challenge for vocational rehabilitation is, as we need to obtain 384 data elements every quarter, we can do it manually. I can have my counselors who are trying to be counselors just do data entry for 384 points on every client, or we can have these arrangements where we have autofill documentation through other systems. And so we're currently working on the agreements with various entities to make sure that we can supplement or document and confirm the information that we do have in order to meet our requirements for that reporting process. When it comes to other data issues, things that aren't shared, well, for us, a lot of specific medical information or life circumstances, we don't share that. And specific disability or medical information. And then the question is also describe where sharing doesn't exist. You know, any place where there is a requirement under the WIOA performance metric reporting that requires confirmation, if there is not a data sharing agreement there for us, we need to get it, because we need to make sure that what we send into the Rehab Services Administration is correct. And it will eventually be compared to the Department of Labor information. That's what they'll do in D.C., and then they'll come back to the states and show where there are discrepancies amongst the programs. So systems like the Oregon Board of Nursing, certain aspects of the educational system, the Board of Licensure, places like that are places where the vocational rehabilitation program is in the process of putting together agreements so that we can have the specific information to document what we're telling the federal government. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. So does the committee have any questions for the second set of questions on data systems? Yes, Rep. Solomon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you had talked about having a system. I mean, a lot about what you're describing is helping match a need with skilled workforce. So do we have the capability of backing that up so that, you know, some of us attended the Western Pathways conference, and they talked a lot about trying to connect what the need is for the workforce to what we're educating our students. So do we have the ability to back that up so that we can connect where we are in our education system, where we're seeing maybe a lack of being able to fill some of these jobs and things like that? Are we able, did that make sense, or am I in like the afternoon fog? It could be. I think so.
I think programs like the SLDS will be hugely valuable to the workforce system to help us target investments and also help us within our sector strategies when we're working with targeted industries like manufacturing, construction, healthcare, to better understand what their need is and then how much and then what that pipeline of talent looks like. At this point, it's hit or miss. You know, some programs or school districts have really valuable information that we can use to say how many programs are turning out individuals from CTE, and others not so much. And so it does become challenging for us to identify how much we have in that pipeline in order to meet the needs going forward. But that is a huge gap.
Chair Alonzo Leon, Representative Solman, I was actually looking at your chart that you were referencing, but if you talk about the data system you just learned about earlier and you talk about what we were just talking about now, everybody on here dumps into one of those systems. So once we get those two things going, we'll be a lot closer to what you want. And we're getting there. And then I wanted to mention, too, that locally, and we've talked about this a little bit in committee, but the local workforce boards are responsible for strategies that connect their education and their businesses and making sure that those things happen. So at a local level, those industry sector strategies that happen, those conversations are happening, even if, you know, the big data numbers aren't there for the whole state for K-12, you know, outcomes being connected to what are the workforce outcomes yet. Those conversations are happening locally, so the connectivity is going on.
Sounds to me that our data system's a little bit behind when we have our workforce boards having those discussions, and I'm sure that has to do with not having enough funding to upgrade and update a lot of our older than dirt systems. It's going to cost money. And, you know, this is, I think I just want to reiterate the importance of it coming from you, that this is what we need to help better have the most updated data to support our current students and the future workforce opportunities for students as they are graduating. Okay, we're going to go into our next set of questions. And basically, they're focused on the impact of an inadequate data system, so a little bit of what I just mentioned. So here are two questions. Would you agree that the current data sharing practice could be improved? What are the impacts of inadequate data sharing, e.g. impacts on customer experience, business experience, staff costs, et cetera? Let's go ahead and have Dan start this time.
Sure, I get the hard question. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, yeah, I think current data sharing practices can definitely be improved. You know, we're limited by, like I said earlier, federal and state rules that and laws, frankly, that state that we are not allowed to share data except for the management of our programs or the administration of our programs. Normally what that means, though, is if I have a TANF recipient who is getting services somewhere, I have them sign a confidentiality agreement, a release of information agreement that I can then share with that vendor, that provider, and we can share information. I think if I was to talk about a dream state, I would talk about a place where when that confidentiality agreement or that release of information is signed, I could get them signed up in our system to use our system, or we're able to share data back and forth through a system. Right now, we're not able to share that data back and forth through a system. I think that has its benefits, believe it or not. I think the joint case management is best done when individuals have a relationship and can sit down and talk with the individual as a group and wrap services around them. So I think there is a benefit there. However, once those relationships are established, I think it would be good if we could share data in real time to actually case manage those programs. Like I said, it would be really difficult to build a system like that because you do need the individual client's permission to share their information, obviously. And but I think if we could get to a place where once that information is shared, where we could jointly case manage a case and we could see what services are happening in real time, I think that would be a benefit. I don't think there's a quick silver bullet for that one because, like I said, we're really limited in what we can share without essentially breaking federal law, and I really try to avoid doing that at all costs. But I do think there's a dream state in which we could get that information for those individuals who want that information shared.
Excellent. Anybody else want to respond to that question? Nope.
I was just going to, sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just really quickly, because we sit at this table, we've talked a lot about this, and you might think we're just doing it when we show up here, but we actually do sit at these tables on a regular basis, and we've been talking about an information relief that our customers have between our two shops, Gemini, and whether or not we can apply that to the rest of the system. So we've actually been working on that with the local boards at the table, talking about what does it need to say so that we'd be able to share that information. We've also been talking about the fact that we have improvements to be made in how many confidentiality or data sharing agreements we have within each agency. So I think that we are starting to peel that back and trying to make that a lot more seamless in terms of having one agreement per agency that will hopefully cover more items, and so that we can more readily share and make it not a burden on the customers. So we are working through some of those things. And when you ask the question about, could the practices be improved, I would hope that we're always in a constant, continuous improvement cycle with all of our data, and that these are just a few things that we're working on currently as we move forward. Particularly, you mentioned, budget. These are things we can do without funding, that we can just change language and do better at our sharing agreements so that we can get access to more data versus, completely changing big systems that are legacy systems.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, going to Dan's, where he says things could be approved, I would agree that as well. But, if you look back 10 years ago, we didn't share anything. I mean, in the one-stop system, my staff would have to run around, get agreement signed by the individual, then have it signed by somebody, then have it notarized, then have somebody else sign it. I mean, it was to the point where you couldn't even do your business. So even 10 years ago, from where we were 10 years ago, is a huge hurdle, because we now have data agreements with other agencies, nonprofits, other organizations, to where they can access the systems, they can go in there, they can provide services to those individuals, or we don't have to run around and ask for information per another staff member that's in there that's working for another organization to find out, is this person eligible? What is their wage record? What are they? Have they been registered in IMAT Skills? Are they registered in the system? They can get that data by themselves, and they don't have to do that. So it's easier for the customer walking through the door. And the stuff we've done with Department of Human Services, 10 years ago, we didn't have that. There are things that we can improve on, but I think we have made those improvements with data sharing agreements and confidentiality agreements with other organizations, so that we can provide that service to those customers.
Thank you, Jim.
Madam.
Yes, go ahead, Bridget.
Madam Chair and members, all of us would agree that data systems have vastly improved in the last decade or so, certainly since 1967. I think that as we move forward, customer experience, user experience as they walk through our system, to share data within an organization across multiple programs is essential to that one organization. And across all of our system partners, those communications are getting better, and that's fabulous. And I think the data sharing that does exist is good, and we need more of it. And I think the biggest challenge that we have is being able to gather information in real time so that staff can better serve individuals and reduce that duplication and, frankly, waste. There's a lot of inefficiencies with trying to track down information, better understand which system an individual is in, and then coordinate and work with those individuals to better serve that client. And so, we need data sharing on the front side. For not just our job seeker customers and youth customers, but also our business customers. And in its current state, there is no information being shared for our business customers, and I think that is a lack of. And I also would like to say that there are conversations moving forward, and technology is not slowing down on our behalf. And technology is going to speed up, and this business is going to speed up, and people are continuing to be challenged, and increasingly so. And so in order to have that all-hands-on-deck approach and to better support individuals, we really do need real-time information across these agency partners.
And because this is an entree into a conversation, and there are already, it sounds like, already some great partnerships that are existing behind the scenes, which is really good, but we have a system that includes more than just those five sitting at this table, and we need to be able to have those conversations to mitigate any of those challenges that our customers are facing on the front end.
Thank you. Pete, do you want to add to these questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had a few thoughts that were probably kind of weedy, but I was thinking in terms of the accuracy of data being shared. It has to be correct because, you know, we're entering into a process where there'll be reconciliation of one-stop center costs and things like that. And so it's just, again, to emphasize the need for accurate, correct data that's utilized for the various buckets that it needs to be utilized for. So there'll be a case management aspect to this where we would like to know where people are in their processes with various places. But, you know, depending on which programs we are, what can we share? How do we get around that? In our case, a lot of it has to do with permission from this client to share more information with someone else working with them, which we're more than happy to do. And so there's just that question as to standardizing release form type information for clients to use. Then there is the program administrative data that just shows who's working with who when, and that stuff needs to be accurate so that we have best cost reconciliation processes and that we, in fact, can quickly react once those comparison lists are made so that people can access other services and leverage resources that might be available to them. Those are a couple thoughts that I had on that.
Thanks, Pete. So now we're going to open it up to questions. I know, Rep. Solomon, you have some questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just was curious, if someone is accessing the state for a service, and I guess I don't understand why we have to then ask permissions across if it's all along workforce. I mean, if it's a matter of getting too much data out there, could we not give that person a number, instead of using the personal information? But I guess that's what I don't understand is I feel like you take one, you have this one stop, but it doesn't really work as a one stop because they have to ask permissions or then go to each individual. So it feels, is that federally protected? Is there a reason?
Well, we do share. Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I mean, we do share, so people who are in the one stops, we do share information with each other within the one stops. We have agreements in place right now, and we're working on agreements right now with self-sufficiency and vocational rehabilitation and Commission to the Blind because they're going to be within the one stops, and so we will have agreements. Now, there's only certain information we want that will help us. We don't need medical records for an individual that we're working with.
Right.
But if Dan and I are working with somebody, Dan comes to me and goes, you know, Jim, I need to know, did this person go to a job that we referred to? Could you help me determine whether this person did? I could, with the data, with the sharing agreements, I could say, yes, Dan, this person did, or no, they did not. So there's ways that we can do that within those data sharing agreements and those information sharing agreements between agencies so that we're not having to have them fight the individual fill out a form so that I can share that information. That's what we've had to do in the past. I mean, they had to literally check, what information are you asking for right now? Sign it. Then if the person comes back later and go, oh, geez, I need this information, you have to have sign this form again, check these boxes, and then I can get you that information. We're going away from that. And we've made, like I said, 10 years ago, that's the way it worked. And so with these agreements, we're able to do that.
Just really quickly, you kind of mentioned, Chair Alonzo Leon, Representative Solomon, members of the committee. People do get a job seeker ID when they come in, and so we do identify them sort of to your mention of sort of do they get an identifier. There is such a thing. And when we talk about self-sufficiency, customers who are coming in now through the partnership that's happening here, they will be in the system that same way and receive that same identifier. So that does happen and is occurring. It would happen for vocational rehabilitation customers as well, without the medical and all of that. And then earlier I referenced that we're working on, we have this very broad statement to Jim's point that people sign in the beginning that say you can release my information for our two federal titles, and we're looking to how that can go across more titles so that we don't have to do this duplicative effort. So those two things I think get to what you're talking about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the thing to remember when we talk about sharing private information is just that as long as the individual has said they're interested in it, we can get there with releases of information, agreements, and things like that. It's the conversation around blanketly saying anybody who receives SNAP, their data should go, or anybody who receives TANF, their data should reside in this system because they've signed up for one public assistance thing, and they should be in another. You know, it is under federal law, we fall under the public assistance side of things, and I don't believe the Employment Department, Wagner-Pizer, or Title I, WIOA services fall under public assistance. So we just can't assign a number and put them jointly share them between agencies. However, for those who sign up for the STEP program, for example, they're saying they want their information into the STEP provider, and they're saying they're interested in that. So that's where we're able to, well, actually in that case, we're able to do it as part of the administration of the program. But if someone from TANF went and signed up with WOMIS and iMatch Skills and they signed that release of information, we're trying to figure out if, is that enough for us to say, yeah, you know, Jim, they are working with a case manager. Here's the case manager's name. Here's the services that can be provided. I'm not sure we're there yet. Well, I know we're not there yet. We haven't run it through the Department of Justice. We haven't run it through our own people yet, and we haven't reached out to ACF. But that's kind of the idea. If they're saying they want to be a part of that process, let's make sharing information part of that process. We're just not quite there yet, but we would like to be.
Okay. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bridget, this question's for you, or maybe you all, but I'm focusing on you. I know your passion for this. How can you quantify or measure improvements? We hear about a lot of stuff that's getting better. It's better than it was back in 67 or better than it was 10 years ago. But is there a way to objectively measure improvements, i.e. better response? I don't know. You tell me, is there a way that we can, you know, a year from now you can say this index is better, or this, you know, outcome is better? Is there a way to do that? Other than just kind of anecdotally, people, it seems like the system's working more smoothly.
Chair Alonzo Leon, committee members, Representative Johnson, that is a good question. How to quantify, you know, that we're on the right
education,
track?
Education, we get and test that scores. You know, we take assessments, blah, blah, blah. You know, you pass that percentage. But within your business, is there an objective way to measure success?
I believe that there is. I think, though, that is going to take a conversation. We are going to have to dig into this and better understand which data systems we're using, which data we're collecting, how is that different, what's working and what's not working about it. I think that if we were to ask staff at our system, in throughout our system, there is a desire to share information. You all received a schematic or a spreadsheet that we created in Clackamas, not to share with this committee, frankly, not to really share outside of our own borders. We created it to better serve people. We needed to better understand how the information we were collecting how do we reduce some of that that trauma that can come with having to repeat your story over and over again. We're not really sure what we're going to do with that, but what we did need to understand is how many systems there are. And with amongst five programs, we were able to identify over seven programs or MIS systems, and that wasn't all inclusive. That were just listed here. And I think that, the conversations that are happening, there's multiple data systems within each organization, and they might be talking amongst each other. And then as it impacts an individual that comes in our door, that's where we really start to see the struggle. And they'll go through a different intake process, whether they go in vocational rehab, walk through WorkSource Oregon, go through Department of Human Services, and that's not trauma-informed. And so in 2017, when we know data systems are getting better every single day, we owe it to our constituents and our public and our businesses to do this better as soon as possible, because we do have people that are struggling. So in a year, what could it look like? I think that could be determined by the people sitting at this table, in addition to the other partners that make up the workforce system, to figure out, like, how do we set that target and move forward. At a minimum, the conversations have to begin so that we can set those targets.
Thank you. And my question is around evaluations. obviously in respect to customer service, how quickly are we reaching out to our constituents, I guess in this case our customers? You know, are they happy? Are they mad because our system is so slow? I mean, how often do we do these?
There are requirements under WIOA to include feedback mechanisms. So there are feedback mechanisms that exist with many of our programs. The employment department issues a business survey to ask businesses, you know, did you get what you needed? There's several other questions that are available. That information is not typically real time, and it is certainly it's coming at it from at different periods of time, and it's not always asking, you know, for instance, somebody in Clackamas County for 1 month, they might not ask any businesses any of those questions. And so to be able to understand trends, we do have to set up feedback mechanisms more real time so that we can respond to those challenges. As far as customer feedback form, those need to increase. Those need to across the board, because individuals don't necessarily know what to expect when they walk through the doors of WorkSource Oregon. We have set ourselves up in a way that if you don't necessarily know who to ask, what to ask, or how to ask, it's challenging to get exactly where you need to go. And so it does become training that on the staff side to be able to best direct people into certain areas, but we do have a large part of our population that are slipping through the cracks as a result of coming in the door, not getting exactly what they need, and then walking out and continuing to live in poverty or low-income situations. And so those feedback mechanisms for our job seekers are crucial.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we developed WorkSource Oregon standards a couple years ago, and those standards are, if you walk into any center within the 37 centers in the state of Oregon, that you will get the same minimum service as you would walking in any of them. We developed those only because we wanted to have a standard for when a job seeker came into a WorkSource center. We also went to the customer-centric model, where the staff were actually out in the center. They're not actually sitting back behind a wall behind closed doors. They're actually out in the resource room. So they engage with that customer one-on-one when they walk through the door. Our expectation is that a customer is greeted with 1 minute and they're actually seen by somebody within 15 minutes. And I would like to say that we're actually meeting that in all our centers. We track that. And the other thing Bridget mentioned a little earlier about surveys, we do survey every job seeker that completes a registration. They do get a survey on there's multiple questions on, you know, the service that was provided to them. There's also a feedback mechanism where, you know, if they want us to contact them, if there's anything that of concern for them. We also survey businesses, so if they have a closed listing, they also send out a business satisfaction survey. And we get high marks. We're in the 97-98 percentile of satisfaction of job seekers and employers. So. And we do take those seriously. I mean, I look at every one of those comments that come back. If there's a comment in there that I see that needs to be addressed, I call my local manager and say, you need to take a look at this, because it does have the job seeker's ID on it, and we can look it up and to see, you know, exactly what did that job seeker say and who it was, and also same thing on the employer side. So we take those very seriously. At least I do, I should say.
Thank you. So we are short on time, and we have two other sets of questions to go through. So I think what I'm going to do is ask one question at a time, and if you guys could respond with a quick answer, very quick answer, so we can just get through them all, and then we'll do the same with the fifth set of questions because we are very short, and then have enough time to ask a couple maybe questions if there's any time left. So this time, let's start with Jim. I'm gonna give you the first question, and then we'll just go around again. Are there federal or state legal or regulatory barriers to further data sharing? If so, what are they?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have certain federal regulations that we have to abide to. What we do is we look at what those are before we make a determination, and then, you know, if there's anything that we can't share, then we will, you know, indicate that, but most of the stuff that we do, there is some sort of an agreement that we can do to share that information. There's very little data that we can share, so for the most part, we do share most of the data that we have. There are some things that we don't share, employer tax ID numbers and those types of things. We just don't share that information across the board. But for the most part, the information we have in IMAT skills that's in there, it's information that's shared. I mean, as long as we go through the process of the confidentiality agreements, we do data sharing agreements with the organization, they can have access to that system. So there's process that they need to go through. We just don't automatically turn it on for them. There are certain criteria that they'll have to do to make sure that they're be able to have access to that.
Thank you. Karen, we'll just go around.
I'm not going to add anything. We're gonna see if with your permission, Chair Alonzo Leon, probably between Dan and Jim, they can answer on behalf of Pete and I as a
Perfect.
System, and then for on this series of questions, and then Bridget. So.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I've said several times, we have several, and it's kind of a laundry list of state and federal regulations around the sharing of public information for those individuals who get public assistance. And really, it breaks down quite simply to if we need to do it for the administration of the program, we're allowed to do it. If we're not allowed to do it for the administration of the program, we're not allowed to do it. And so that is our biggest barrier, is both those federal and state laws that essentially bar us from doing anything that's not for the administration and management of the program.
Anything else?
I would just echo what they said.
Okay. Easy enough. Are there technical barriers to data sharing? If so, what are they? Yes, please.
Very briefly, technical thing that we're dealing with is a lack of resources. We have very few people in the VR program to negotiate and identify the agreements that need to be made, and once they are done, then we have to work through the Office of Information System and the Department of Justice to get everything approved. It just takes time, but we're working on many. They just are in the pipeline.
Okay. Anybody else want to respond to that?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think from a technical... yeah, both of you. I'm sorry.
The people who count have stayed.
Thank you for staying and fighting the good fight.
It's a bonding experience. But Ledge Days is all about.
I may or may not have mentioned that our systems are from 1967. There are a lot of technical barriers to data sharing. But given enough time, I think that our IT system, when resourced properly, can overcome those barriers.
And I would echo just age of systems. That's barriers.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, excellent. Are there cultural or institutional barriers to data sharing? If so, please describe. And feel free to jump in, since we're limited on time, whoever wants to start.
I just want to talk for a second about the Self-Sufficiency Department of Human Services kind of institutional barrier as I see it. We are currently undergoing an integrated eligibility project where we're trying to, and we will accomplish this, I have faith in our process here, make it so that an individual who comes in can become eligible and apply once for services within the self-sufficiency program. So currently, and we did this the other day, one of our IT people brought in the paper applications from all three of our programs, and it was almost 2.5 pounds of paper. What we're getting to with this system, and unfortunately it's over a $200 million system at this point, we're about 2 years into it, have about a year and a half left, we'll have this integrated eligibility process where someone will be able to apply online or in person for all of our programs at one time. That'll include our medical programs, which we just began running again on September 1st. OHA and Department of Human Services came to an agreement that the Department of Human Services would run those eligibility programs. So it'll include medical, employment-related daycare, SNAP, TANF, and I believe it's long-term care through the APD program. We're excited about that. Unfortunately, what that does for us is gives us really limited resources, as Pete alluded to. Anybody who can, we're going to have these 1967 systems. Some of them are still going to have to talk to this new system. We are really tapped with where we're putting people. We need them on this new project in order to meet timelines and deadlines and try to stay as close to budget as possible. And we are having a really hard time getting anything done that is not related to the IEME process at this point.
Thank you, Dan. Yes.
I think as far as cultural or institutional barriers, there have been comments or it's been noted that there are federal and state barriers or laws or mandates, and I think better understanding those and where those pain points are, and is there an opportunity to engage this committee and the legislature to help to mitigate some of those, and so just better understanding those across our system, partners would be valuable for us to kind of dive into. So I would say that there appear to be these barriers, and so what can we do to help mitigate them?
Thank you. And the last question of this set of questions, are there any other barriers that are important to consider that you have not mentioned? Okay. Well enough. Any remaining members of the committee, do you have any questions for our panel?
Are we still getting out by three, Madam Chair?
Yeah, five.
I do have two questions, but I just want to put them on the record. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I see you all out in the world, or maybe we can have an offline conversation about it, that would be great. So thank you, Madam Chair. The first is I just wanted to say I believe that people should always be in control of their own data. That's very important to me, and making sure that we don't act very cavalier about people's data is important. So my first question is, are there cases in the management process where a client would object to blanket sharing of their data? So like when you go to the doctor's office, they kind of tell you what they'll share and how they'll share it, and you have the opportunity to opt out. And then the second was, is there an opportunity to request a federal or state waiver for a trial group where we just share data under, you know, kind of a blanket situation, and see how it works, to see if we can kind of scale it back or refine it for the larger group. So
I would just like to say, to answer your first question about which populations, one that comes to mind would be domestic violence survivors. Their information is hugely confidential, and so I would say that that is one group that comes to mind.
Okay. Thanks. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, in our world, it's usually mental health clients who don't wish to share for many different reasons, not all of which mm-hmm. we can deal with, but we handle that through a counseling process to try and explain the benefit of agreeing to work with other folks.
So Representative Alonzo Leon and Rep. Bynan, there is actually, when they register in WOMIS, at the very bottom before they actually finish their process, it does say we share this information with multiple state agencies or multiple workforce partners, and they can decline that. So.
Sorry. Chair Alonzo Leon and Representative Bynum. I think the waiver idea is really interesting, and I think we can go back and talk about that with our individual funders. One of the difficulties is we all have different federal funders, but I think Oregon is seen as an innovator in a lot of these areas, and it may be something we could take back as an idea and see how far we could take it. So I appreciate that thought.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you know, it was interesting when we got the ability to share aggregate data with the PRISM system. At the same time, within IMATCH Skills and WOMA, and within IMATCH Skills, there was an opportunity for people to self-attest to whether they were receiving SNAP or TANF. And the numbers were really low. And when we did the aggregate data match, it was much, much, much higher. So I think there is definitely a fear amongst some of our participants, or an embarrassment amongst some of our participants, that they don't wish to disclose that they're on public assistance. And I totally understand that, and I think that should be respected as well. So if we were to ask for some kind of pilot, I'd want to be sure that we definitely had an opt-out option for individuals, because I think for a lot of people, being on public assistance is something they're not proud of. It's something they need, and it's something we need to be able to provide and not hinder their ability to access additional resources that the state may be able to provide to help them find employment and move forward with their lives. So.
Thank you. So we have one last question, or the last set of questions. In brief, less than 30 seconds, whoever wants to respond, what does the ideal future of data sharing look like? Are there opportunities for legislative, executive, or other action to support your vision? Feel free to jump in if you have a response.
Chair Alonso Leon and committee members, we really shared our future state and opportunities that to engage in the conversation within our introductory statement, which we submitted in preparation for this. We would love to have those conversations on our side, and then jointly come up with a concept or idea of how to best be served or connected to this committee and the legislature. So if we can create an opportunity in lockstep to then come back to you, I think that that would be the desire of the workforce board.
Wonderful. Any other comments from the rest of the panelists?
I think I shared a little earlier about what my dream would be, that people who choose to be a part of it, we could share data quickly and easily in real time. I think that would be the ideal for me. The true ideal for me would be that I had no data to share because we didn't have individuals receiving our benefits.
Right.
So that may or may not happen, but that would be the trigger.
It's a good dream to have. Committee members, any last parting questions, comments?
Okay.
Well, thank you, panelists. I really appreciate all the information and all the systems that are that is working together. You have a lot of responsibility. We're supporting so many of our community members in Oregon, and we want to be as efficient as possible in providing the support that our community members need. But we understand that some of our systems are just not available to meet the needs as quickly as we want them. And we definitely want to work together with you all and helping you make sure you have the capacity, the systems that are functioning, so that we can better support our community members. I agree, Dan, you know, we want to get to the point where we don't need these services, right? That's our ultimate goal, I agree. But till then, we want to make sure that we are efficient in our work and that we are providing the resources and support systems to our many families who need us. But it takes us, all of us, working together. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I'm closing this informational hearing. I am closing this meeting.